Thank you. We'll call the joint meeting of the House Committee on Energy Finance and Policy and the Senate Committee on Energy Utilities, Technology and Communications to order. I should mention that Senator Pretner Solon was not able to be here today, nor was her committee vice chair, but we have sitting in for them the Senate author of the peak oil resolution, Senator Carlson, will be filling in for them today. And I want to thank members for a good turnout on such a difficult travel day. We've heard from at least one member who had a spin out about halfway here and was still trying to decide which direction to go from that. And I think he probably decided to go back north, but we'll see. A couple weeks ago, at the in the invitation to a different hearing, somewhat on the same subject, I quoted a report that I hope everyone who is not already familiar with it will make themselves familiar. The Hirsch report that was done at the behest of the Department of the U.S. Department of Energy. A study on global petroleum supplies, and I just think it's appropriate to begin the hearing with a quotation from the beginning of that report. Peaking of world oil production presents the U.S. and the world with an unprecedented risk management problem. As peaking is approached, liquid fuel prices and price volatility will increase dramatically. And without timely mitigation, the economic, social, and political costs will be unprecedented. Viable mitigation options exist on both the supply and demand sides, but to have substantial impact, they must be initiated more than a decade in advance of peaking. That was followed in 2005 and 2006. The Government Accounting Office submitted a report to Congress entitled "Uncertainty about Future Oil Supply Makes It Important for Developing a Strategy for Addressing a Peak and Decline in Oil Production." We have called this meeting today. It's an informational hearing. There will be no action taken. I do anticipate taking up the resolution, House File 995, once session begins for action, and at that time we will certainly invite testimony from any interested parties on any side of the issue. Today, however, we are very fortunate to have with us one of the world's leading experts on the subject of global petroleum supply, commonly known as peak oil. We will get to his testimony in just a few moments. I think there will be opportunity for questions at the end, and we'll ask Mr. Simmons if he would like to entertain questions as he goes through the presentation. I think looking at the audience, this is probably someone that does not really need an introduction. But for those of you who would appreciate an introduction, we're very fortunate to have with us today Matthew Simmons, who's the chairman and CEO of Simmons and Company International, which is a Houston-based investment bank that specializes in the oil industry. He gained quite a bit of prominence a few years ago with the publication of this book called Twilight in the Desert, which is his analysis of the Saudi Arabian oil production situation, and we will be hearing about that this afternoon. Actually, Mr. Simmons has such an extensive biography that rather than go into it and take up the precious time away from his presentation, I think we will just go ahead and ask him to begin. Mr. Simmons, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Goldstein. I appreciate all of you coming out to hear about this issue called peak oil. If you'll see by the time I finish up, I think you'll appreciate why I believe, and I think a growing number of people who have studied this issue believe, that this will be the defining challenge of the 21st century. And it is so much more immediate than any other problem that we know about today that it still baffles me that so few people even understand properly what the term peak oil means. But hopefully by the end of this afternoon, you'll certainly have at least a lot more data that I'm going to present in these PowerPoint slides. It does surprise me to be sitting here speaking about this, because nothing in my background ever led me to think until I was about 26 that I would ever be involved in any aspect of the petroleum industry. Luckily, I got involved early on in raising some venture capital for one of the leading companies in the diving business that really were pioneering the ability of man to go below about 100 feet of water. And it was so exciting, and the growth of this company was so dramatic, that I turned my entire rest of my professional career over to being an energy investment banker. And knowing nothing about energy, I really tried my hardest to work at being an honest student of energy. And over the last 15 years, the more that I have studied, which is a lot more than I used to do, the more convinced I am that this is a problem that is real, it's on our doorstep today, and we've got to figure out some way to start adjusting our lives, or we might not have much of a remaining 21st century to live through. Let me just start with a few very obvious key peak oil facts.
First of all, Mr. Simmons, before we begin, first of all, I need you to identify yourself for the tape, and I would like to take this opportunity to ask members and members of the audience if you have cell phones or any kind of electronic devices, please take this opportunity to turn them off.
Okay, I am Matt Simmons, Chairman of Simmons & Company, the Houston Energy Investment Banking Firm, and I will address peak oil. Let me start out with some obvious key peak oil facts. First of all, the definition. The easiest thing about peak oil's definition is to remind ourselves that we don't mean running out of oil. What it means is when the world's oil supply reaches its highest sustainable output. Once this peak is reached, oil supply cannot grow. Just the law of physics. Once production goes through some form of plateau, which might or might not be relatively long or relatively short, then decline will follow. The rate of decline is going to vary by the type of crude oil and the reservoir drainage plan. Some can be quite slow, but some can be unbelievably rapid. Oil wells, oil fields, which is just a collection of oil wells, oil basins, which is a collection of oil fields, and oil-producing countries, will all reach peak output. It's just a question of when. Another obvious fact is that oil production cannot grow forever. Oil is non-renewable, or at least 99.9% of the oil authorities in the last 100 years believe it's non-renewable. In the last 100 years, oil demand, which started so tiny, grew at least 100-fold. It's really amazing. The first good statistics we have globally on the use of oil was right after World War I, when the world was using just less than 2 million barrels a day. My guess is that in 1900, we were probably globally using maybe a half a million barrels a day, maybe less. Single biggest oil product at the time was Vaseline, the petroleum jelly. But basically, through the miracle of the internal combustion engine and the miracle of finding more and more oil, demand did grow 100-fold in a century. Oil now accounts for 95% plus of all of our transportation energy. crude oil's byproduct, which is largely associated natural gas, creates basically the backbone of the petrochemical industry that creates the chemical industry, that creates the plastic industry, and just thousands of things. The picture I have here came out of an article, a cover story of National Geographic about 3 years ago on the end of cheap oil, and everything in this yard still is basically made of a petroleum component. Oil for our society is like oxygen for the human body. The human body needs a whole lot of other things, but without oxygen, about 3 minutes later, we need nothing. And literally, without oil, our industrial society as we know it today shuts down. The other thing that's interesting is, while oil is non-renewable, the future growth in oil demand now appears to be literally inexhaustible. But someday, oil supply will peak. The law of physical limits will finally trump increased need. And when supply can no longer grow, then we have now reached peak oil. The peak oil issue is poorly understood. The peak oil debate, which I think in earnest began probably in May 2002 when the first study for the Association of Peak Oil Confab was held at Uppsala University in Sweden. About 45 of us showed up. It did make the headline news on Swedish television that night. Today there are, I would gather, 15 to 20 associated with the AFPO, Association for the Study of Peak Oil, chapters around the world. There's chapters rising. I was told earlier today that there's one that's been formed about 100 miles west of here. But what's interesting is, as the debate has intensified, it's still minuscule compared, for instance, to the debate going on about global warming. If you just Google global warming on Google, you'll get about 80 million hits. You Google peak oil, you get about 3 million hits. That's probably a pretty good allocation of how we're paying attention to this. And also, many well-known oil pundits really loudly scoff at peak oil issues. These energy economists loudly deny that peak oil is a serious risk. Groups like Cambridge Energy Research Associates, who have a very prominent voice in the petroleum industry globally, proclaim that peak oil will happen, that it's decades away, and will then be followed by a lengthy undulating plateau for another several decades. And so, yes, it's a problem, but it's a problem more like a 2100 problem versus a problem today. Almost all of the optimists, and I've met most of them, and I've attended conferences, and I hear them present their views, are betting their thesis on effectively four or five key points. First of all, that we're now able to recover a lot more oil that we used to leave in the ground. Secondly, we still have vast amounts of undiscovered oil that we're going to discover. Third, that we have an exponential increase in oil field technology that is basically allowing us to both recover more oil and find more oil and just be more innovative. And fourth, we're going to have vast increases in non-conventional oil, and then they'll point to the fact that Canada has in non-conventional oil just as much oil as Saudi Arabia, and so therefore we won't have a problem. These are all interesting points, but there is almost no hard data to support any of these beliefs. We've also seen, as all of you know, in the last 9 years, an astonishing tenfold rise in oil prices. Why? From 1998-99, when a lot of pundits assumed that oil prices would collapse from $10 to $5 a barrel, it didn't do that, it rose. Many at that time believed that the world was literally drowning in oil. The subsequent price rise has baffled almost all pundits, and rather than acting as any sort of a free market signal, what's amazed me is the price rise has been explained away by an aberration, by hedge fund-driven trading, by the war premiums, by fears and so forth. I continually read about how well supplied the market is, which is basically saying we haven't had shortages yet, so therefore we have lots of oil. And then there's been a constant theme going all the way back when oil finally crossed $30 a barrel that, don't worry, the high price will soon start to kill demand and then we'll have a glut again. And so if this 9-year period of time, while this price rise might have been a signal, in my opinion, it just flew right by us. And it turns out, with the benefit of hindsight, which is one of our best analytical tools we have, that oil pundits turned out to have virtually everything wrong. In the 1990s, their views were widely expressed. Their views included the fact that it would appear that global oil demand was peaking, and the reason for that was between about 1988 and 1994, global oil demand stayed in a rut of about 67 to 68 million barrels a day. They basically came to the conclusion that oil field technology and the revolution we'd had that was making the cost of oil steadily cheaper, this was going to lead to a supply glut, The fourth quarter of next year, having a supply gut became a common theme for about a decade. The assumption also was that low oil prices were beneficial to everyone, and they certainly were a great boon to the consumers, but they were basically killing the industry. There was also an assumption that weak players have an unsustainable business model, and this will just basically have the fittest survive. And then someone came up with an unbelievable conclusion that Moore's Law, which the inventor of semiconductors came up with, observing that about every decade a technology change and makes it about half as costly to produce semiconductors, has now arrived in oil and gas, and that every 10 years the price would fall in half. The Economist luckily codified this conventional wisdom in this beautiful cover story that you can see in the PowerPoint called Drowning in Oil. It came out in March of 1999. What the article basically said is that oil prices won't stay at 10, they're headed to 5. They'll stay there for a long time because Saudi Arabia with a $100 billion war chest is going to flood the world with oil for several decades until they finally knock out all competition. What was so interesting about this cover story to me was about 6 days before I saw this on a newsstand in Amsterdam, I got a call one morning from this guy at The Economist in London. And he said, "Mr. Simmons, I've been working on a really important oil story for about 6 weeks, and while I'm new to the oil desk at The Economist, I'm kind of a long-time writer, and several people, and the thesis is, oil's headed to 5, Saudi Arabia's going to flood the world with oil, and several people keep saying, you want to talk to the Simmons Grand Institute." And he tells me all about this, and I said, "That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Saudi Arabia's insolvent today. Mexico's insolvent. Venezuela's insolvent. The industry is basically on the ropes because of $10 oil, and if we keep oil at 10 for another year, we're going to basically see supply drop so fast that your head will spin." And he said, "Mr. Simmons, you have to be wrong. I've spent 6 weeks. I've talked to everybody. I've talked to the CEOs of Shell, Exxon, BP, Danier, Natura, and so forth. Well, their timing turned out to be perfect. The cover story coincided with the end of the worst price collapse we've had in the last 50 years, literally to the week. Came out on a Tuesday morning. On Thursday afternoon in Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and Mexico engineered a 2 million barrel a day cut in production because they were literally on the verge of insolvency, and within 18 months oil prices were at 37. The collapse that we've had was driven by the perception of a market glut. The International Energy Agency spent the better part of 2 years, month by month, talking about the unbelievable growth of the glut, but it never showed up anyplace, and so they called it their infamous missing barrels. Always quote, capitalized M, capitalized B, and by the apex of the collapse, we were looking for over 700 million barrels of oil that had disappeared someplace, which was physically utterly impossible. And this simple physical cut of 2 million barrels a day in early March pinched a very balanced market, and the rest is history." How wrong was conventional wisdom with the benefit of hindsight? Well, first of all, demand didn't peak. In fact, it grew. In fact, interestingly enough, by the very end of 1995, the careful observers of the global supply and demand numbers saying, "Oh my gosh, look at the growth we've had finally in oil demand, as we finally crossed 70 million barrels a day for the first time in human history." In the first quarter of 2007, that should be 2008, excuse me, we have crossed 88 million barrels a day. So basically, in 13 years, grow by 18 million barrels a day is basically, as effectively, doubling the output of Saudi Arabia's oil, and we didn't plan on. Finding costs actually never fell. We went for about a decade when finding development costs per barrel stayed at about $5 to $6 a barrel, but this turned out to be largely the illusion of massive reserve additions that never materialized. So while the costs were rising, basically the per barrel kept being lower, most of the reserve additions, with a bit of hindsight, were fictitious. Technology did have an impact. It induced a sharp rise in decline curves, and few ever grasped the power and fury of depletion, i.e. how fast is oil now declining from existing fields. Why did oil prices rise so much? Well, first of all, they were far too cheap. $10 oil would have killed supply, creating insolvency for most of the industry players and producing countries. As demand grew, supply growth began to sputter. Too many key regions began to peak and decline. Too often demand edged ahead of supply, and too often we've actually filled that gap by liquidating our oil stocks or inventories, which is a very dangerous way to balance the market. Our oil price is now at some sort of a magical tipping point. When we briefly crossed $100 a barrel in the first week of 2008, I read a whole bunch of articles saying, well, clearly now oil prices have peaked. Clearly this is going to kill demand. Economies are getting hurt. The price is going to trigger new supplies, alternative energy sources. Auto and other energy efficiencies are finally going to mushroom. And ironically, these are the same old arguments that were used when oil prices crossed 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80. Estimates vary among a lot of the oil price predictors as to what constitutes a fair price for oil. The consensus forecast for 2008 is we'll settle down to about $70 to $85 a barrel, and most of these same people think over the horizon we'll be back to far lower oil prices because we really don't have a problem. How unfair is $100 a barrel oil? Well, some politicians blame it all on greed, and consumers, there's no question, would rather pay less for a product that's a necessity. And the price is, without question, historically at peak levels. But I'd like to basically, if there's any one number that you ought to walk away with today, it's remembering that $100 a barrel equates to 14.9 cents a cup. Looking at it this way, my opinion, oil is still dirt cheap. $3.20 motor gasoline is basically a bargain at 20 cents a cup. A cup of motor gasoline sounds like a fairly trivial amount until you realize that you can take a 2,000-pound car, put six people in it, put luggage in the trunk, roll up the windows, air conditioning, go 2 miles for 20 cents. It's a remarkable bargain. The other side of the oil story is basically what I would call the fundamentals. Because there are basically some powerful fundamentals at work that would argue to me that it wasn't a surprise that oil prices went up tenfold. Oil demand growth is not basically an aberration. It's being propelled by some very powerful factors. Solid U.S., European, and Asian industrial economies. The OECD growth in the last 10 years was surprisingly robust. In the last 5 years, the total volume growth of oil demand in the United States of America was about equal to the total volume growth in China. So it's easy to blame all this on China and India, but you know, look at home and see. We have soaring oil use for the first time ever throughout the developing world. Back in 1970, on the verge of our first big oil shock, the industrialized countries that we now call the OECD were basically consuming about 85% of the world's oil, and the other 85% of the world was consuming the other 15. Today, the industrialized countries, the OECD, are consuming about 50 million barrels a day of oil, and the other five-sixths of the world are consuming basically 35. So while they're growing like topsy, it's still a very tiny proportion on a per capita basis. Transportation is an economic necessity, and there are no energy substitutes for transportation. That's what oil is all about. In the meantime, oil supply growth has faltered. And measured oil stocks, which are skimpy in our measurement system, are now too low. In fact, maybe far too low. The International Energy Agency, located in Paris, which was one of the two entities we created in the aftermath of the 1973 oil shock, spends a rigorous amount of time carefully doing, updating every odd year, their oil and gas and energy supply and demand models out for the next 25 years. And so in 2007, they updated their outlook to 2030. What's so interesting about these detailed work is they're all demand-driven models. They very carefully look at all the elements of what drives energy demand in total and then what drives oil demand in total and come out with some very detailed assumptions. Then on the supply side, they just fill in the gaps to say, well, if that's demand, how do we get the supply? But the demand numbers are actually worth looking at. They first of all show in total energy demand that basically we have about a 50 to 60% total growth in energy that we need to plan for between now and 2030. Largely created by fossil fuels, largely created by coal, oil, and natural gas, which are fossil fuels. On the oil scene, basically the demand increases most rapidly in China and India and other developing countries. In fact, this astonishing growth they show assumes that the OECD basically stays flat over this period of time. That might or might not happen. Here's what's basically driving China. It's real simple. In the United States of America, we have about 820 million vehicles per 1,000 people. In China, per 1,000 people, they have 18. But in 2005, for the first time ever, China became the second largest purchaser of cars in the world, passing Japan. And on the current trajectories that are fairly conservative, by 2015, they'll overtake the United States of America in total car sales. India is basically, you know, bringing up the rear. It's actually been very interesting for me to watch the incredible growth out of China, and then just note that on a per capita basis, growth in India is basically lagging about 50%. So basically, you can see this enormous growth that's planned in India. It was very interesting 2 weeks ago to see the introduction of the first $2,400 automobile in India. So if you wanted anything to propel use of oil, that $2,500 car is the magic bullet. What the International Energy Agency concluded in this November 2007 report was that the global energy system is on an increasingly unsustainable path. In the 30-year history of the IEA in Paris, this is the first time basically since the early 70s that they've started issuing a cautionary note. In fact, if I have a fault with the IEA is that for the last decade they've been a cheerleader for cheap oil and basically have had their head buried in the sand about a lot of these issues. There's an enormous revolution going on in the IEA today to actually change that. They basically said that China and India are transforming the global energy scene by their sheer size, and that the pace of capacity additions will be most rapid, and basically the challenges are global, so the solutions must be global. But what troubles the International Energy Agency's leadership today is that our oil markets lack any form of transparency on many key supply issues. There is no Middle East deal by field production data, period. Trust me, is the best assurances we have. There's no data on field-specific decline rates other than a handful of regions of the world. We don't know how much they've risen. We don't know how high they are today, and we don't know how fast they might rise. Our oil markets have skimpy data on oil stocks, the inventories that we need to keep the system moving. The United States has the best-in-class oil stocks in the world, but our data system is skimpy at best. Some of the OECD countries have pretty good data. Japan has very good data. Germany has good data on heating oil. Most of the rest of the data we're just guessing, and there is no inventory data of any reliability outside the OECD. Amazing we don't have this data. What the IEA plans to do, though, is no more. And by November of this year, they hope to basically publish the results of the most intensive, rigorous review that's ever been done on all of the available data on 250 of the world's largest oil and gas fields by volume. They think that that probably represents about 65 or 70% of the world's oil supply. It might be 80%. It certainly is more than 50%. And basically what's interesting is that this is the first time that any serious entity has actually ever rolled up their sleeve to say, you know, we want to actually know what's going on. I suspect that by November, one of the most stunning parts of this report is the fact that we have no knowledge on many of these areas, and there's no seeming way to get any knowledge. But by year end, they hope to finally shed some light on the decline rate by fields and on the remaining light speed oil available and how we're starting to now rapidly substitute heavy, gunky oil for what we used to live on, which is light speed oil. And this will also reveal to the extent that no reliable data exists. If one spends time, as I do virtually daily, digging through the best data we have, some very troubling data surfaces. We have rapid decline rates that have been very visible for the last decade on a field-by-field basis that have spread throughout the entire North Sea. We have the United States of America, which basically, in, you know, 35 years, 38 years ago, in 1970, peaked in the lower 48, is by far the largest oil producer on Earth when we crossed 10 million barrels a day. That number today is down to 3, and if you take stripper wells out, which are the wells that produce less than 10 barrels a day, this is a 2.2 barrels per well that account for about 900,000 of the two. The rest is down to 2.1. So in 38 years, we went from 10 to 2.1. We have the North Slope, which basically was our last great supply hope that came on in 1978-79. In 1989, it peaked at 2 million barrels a day. The North Slope is now down to about 800,000 barrels a day. We have the Gulf of Mexico, which I'll show in a few minutes, is an unbelievable decline rate in the deep water Gulf of Mexico that is probably peaking today. Indonesia was one of the charter members of OPEC. 3 years ago, Indonesia no longer exported any oil. Today, they've become a surprisingly strong oil importer. Two reasons. Their demand grew, and their internal production fell. Mexico is facing an unbelievable crisis on our doorstep. Mexico has a great oil field called Cantarell, which has been about 60% of all the oil they've produced the last three decades. It's now the world's second largest producing oil field. It categorically peaked in May 2005 and has now already declined by 41%. We have bits and pieces of data all pointing to the peaking of oil supplies in various parts of the world. We have some data out of the Energy Information Administration. This is the informational arm of the Department of Energy, who report month by month their best assessment of global crude oil production. And if you basically just follow this crude oil production growth, in May 2005, it reached an all-time record of 74.3 million barrels a day. It got almost back to that a year later. It got back to that one more time before it started to fall. And as of late summer, it was down almost 2 million barrels a day from when it peaked. Has crude oil finally snapped back? Well, in the last monthly report that came out in January by the EIA, they show basically a strong rebound from August at 72.5 up to October preliminary data at 74.1. So the optimists within the EIA, the EIA is loaded with a bunch of analytical optimists, say, oh, that was just a temporary decline. But if you take time to basically see where were the big increases between August and October, they were basically Iraq, Saudi Arabia, United Kingdom, Angola, Mexico, Norway, and Russia. And in the case of United Kingdom, Mexico, and Norway, those are in irreversible decline. So that was just an end of summer maintenance bounce. It's also interesting to just step back and examine, if the world's only using 73 million barrels a day of crude oil, how do we get to 85? Well, in 2006, we did average 84.6 million barrels a day of petroleum use. It's just interesting to see how we make up that slate today, very different than a decade or two ago. Black crude, or what we call crude oil, was 73.5. Natural gas liquids was 7.8 million barrels a day, a steady growth in liquids. And then refinery processing gains, a tiny amount of other, which is a tiny amount of synthetic crudes and biofuels, and then stock draws made up the balance. And balancing that market through liquidating stocks is Russian roulette of the highest order. If crude oil can get back to a record output of 74.3 in the next few months, it still creates an incredible need for this output to start to soar. Because world oil demand of 90 million barrels a day is probably right around the corner. If we were at 88 million barrels a day in the first quarter of this year, then getting to 90 is a hop, skip, and a jump, but that would absolutely require crude oil supply to go from the 74 record up to 77 to 78. That's more growth than we've had in the last 5 years. World oil demand of 100 million barrels a day would require at least 87 to 88 million barrels a day of crude oil supply. We'll just never get there. What if the bounce is just an aberration? Could this be a new trend? Well, I don't think it is a new trend because, as I pointed out, three of the seven big gainers are in irreversible decline. Iraq maybe has some long-term potential, but is absolutely at a maximum ability now. Saudi Arabia is banking the whole nine yards on a very extensive rehabilitation of four or five old oil fields that are falling behind plan because they can't get the necessary equipment. Angola has real growth in the deep water, but that's real growth of 500,000 to a million barrels a day. And they're sitting on an old production base of about 700,000 barrels a day, and so some of that growth will likely be offset by a decline of their old oil. These can help offset accelerating decline rates in other countries, but how does the world, in best case, climb back towards 80 million barrels a day? And in the investment banking business, some of us old-timers have always basically said, when you're analyzing data, you better believe the trend is your friend. So if you have 5 years of a company that's been performing at 5% profit margins and they forecast they're going to be at 20, don't believe it. But if, in fact, we don't bounce back, and if, in fact, that general decline actually becomes a trend, what's scary is by 2012, we'd be down to 69 million barrels a day of crude. In an era when we thought we'd be basically, you know, climbing towards 95 million barrels a day of petroleum demand. There's also some data that comes out annually by the Oil and Gas Journal. In fact, it's actually as skimpy as some of the data is. It's the best field-by-field production data we have in the world. They list over 80 countries that produce oil, and in almost all the countries, they name the producing oil fields that these countries have. The discovery dates are listed for many of the fields, most of the fields, and the number of producing wells are reported by field in many cases and by country in all cases. And the 2006 data, where they have basically individual oil field production, account for about 32% of the world's current oil fields and current oil production. The holes in this data is that they basically sum up the United States of America by state because we have 36,000 individual oil fields. They're all tiny, with the exception of about 10. Russian production, they don't report field by field as a state secret, so they basically report Russian production by country. And then almost all the oil producers basically just, they show the fields and they show the accumulated production, but as a matter of state secrets for the last 25 years, they basically do not reveal any field by field production. China has no field discovery dates, but good production by field, and then there's production by field lacking in about maybe another 15%. But even with this, with these holes, this data turns out to also be best in class. Here's sort of what a real careful dig through that data concludes, is that 2006 global oil production is being anchored by fields that were discovered between 1950 and the end of the 1980s. Only 15% of our reported production in 2006 came from fields that were discovered in the 1990s. Only 2% of the reported production comes from fields that were discovered from 2000 through 2006. Discoveries clearly peaked in the 1970s, 1980s era. There were sharp declines in the number of discoveries and discoveries by size in the 1990s, and then only minuscule reported 2,000 plus discoveries that are now producing any significant oil. This is just for your records, the chronological history of these, of this data. Decline rate data also can be dug out. It just takes a lot of digging, and it doesn't cover enough of our fields. But the data is on decline is far richer than some people think. And again, if you dig it out, in my opinion, it paints a scary story. Too many countries are now experiencing high single-digit decline rates. 15 to 20% decline rates by countries are no longer an unusual factor. And with no field-by-field production data in the Middle East, decline rates there remain an incredible mystery. There's a fabulous blog on the internet called The Oil Drum that some of you, as I've chatted before, are active readers on. It's a very sophisticated exchange of information by a lot of the technical people in the industry. And two collaborators from Australia about 2 weeks ago posted some excellent peak oil graphs showing the handful of countries that are still growing and the relentless decline going on in the countries you see in the middle graph there. And the steepness of these graphs sort of takes your breath away. The Gulf of Mexico, it has some fabulous field-by-field production data that the Minerals Management Department has in their public database. This takes a long time to get this data in a user-friendly form. The Gulf of Mexico has anchored 20% of the United States oil for the past decade. A growing percentage of Gulf of Mexico's oil comes from a very small number of deep-water fields. The remaining base consists of oil fields that are now 30 to 50 years old. Let me put that in perspective by saying that Mars Ursa, which is one of our largest deep water fields coming on in 1999-2000, now accounts for 17%, one field, of all the Gulf of Mexico's production. The next four largest fields bring you up to 30%. The next five fields taking you up to the top 10 bring you up to 50%. If you basically take the top 20 fields in the Gulf of Mexico, which are basically 55%, and then you subtract those from the other 698 fields, you find the rest of the fields in the Gulf of Mexico are now producing less than 1,000 barrels a day per field. So we're sitting on a production base of very tiny fields and a handful of very large fields. Deepwater fields peak fast and swiftly decline. But in the Gulf of Mexico, these deepwater fields are basically now anchoring our decline. And with the production profile, which I'll show you in a minute, takes about 1 to 3 years before you reach peak. And most of the fields within the first 5 years have an 85% decline at a rate under average is 25% per annum. So this created a classic treadmill race between technology and depletion. The Cantarell story is case study number 1, 2, and 3 of peak oil. Mexico's supergiant oil field was discovered in 1975. Ironically, the field was discovered by accident. It turns out for about a decade, a group of fishermen would storm into the Pemex office in Veracruz and say, what happened to my fishing nets as I was out trolling for fish in the Bay of Campeche? My net just totally soaked with oil. And finally, Pedro Cantarell, which gave him the name, they named the field after him, protested so loudly that they decided, why, we don't have any wells out there. So they went out and tested and found these unbelievable seeps. And that was the first significant oil that Mexico had ever found in the Gulf of Mexico, in their Gulf of Mexico. Production began in 1977. From 1977 through 1997, this remarkable field produced 1 million barrels a day, virtually every day, from 40 producing wells. And then, 1997, the reservoir pressure started to peak. started to wane. Mexico panicked because this was basically the whole underpinned their whole economy. They basically went from 40 wells to 400 producing wells, and they spent $20 million on a massive nitrogen injection program to reactivate pressure. And basically, the nitrogen squeezed out the last easy oil. It essentially worked too well. What was this like? We're taking a toothpaste tube that's largely depleted of easy-to-get-out toothpaste, and then finally putting about 100 pinpricks in it and smashing on the sidewalk with your heel of your foot. And that's what happened to Cantarell. Cantarell is a classic decline curve study. And Cantarell's data is very transparent. These are real numbers. The North Sea is very transparent. These are real numbers. You see any undulating plateau? You see many plateaus of any? These are all basically up and down. Prudhoe Bay. Prudhoe Bay basically could have produced 3 to 3.5 million barrels a day if they basically let it rip. But in fact, they really carefully wanted to figure out how do we maximize the output of Prudhoe Bay so that we can pay for the last in pipelines. And they figured that if you basically produced at 1.5 million barrels a day by controlling your rate of production, you could probably go 11 years before you reach peak production went into decline. And they missed their forecast by about a quarter, astonishingly. But once it went in decline, it went into irreversible decline. And now if you strip out the 3 satellite wells that make up about a third of Prudhoe Bay, it's down below 300,000 barrels a day. So between 89 at 1.5 and today, it had massive decline. But for some odd reason, we've now entered into a new decline rate debate. Cambridge Energy Research Associates, CERA, which have a very powerful voice, the think tank out of Washington, D.C., just came out with a study 10 days ago saying that they've studied 811 fields. It's the most comprehensive field-by-field study ever done on depletion. And the average decline rate is only 4.5% per year, not 8%, as alarmist claims. And they basically said that what we found in our study is decline rates are steady. Well, even if this turned out to be true, which I think is frankly highly unlikely, it still means that we need to create a brand new Iran every year. And then if you look at their forecast demand going out to 2017, and you take a 4.5% decline rate of the existing base, we merely need to add 59 million barrels a day of new crude in a decade, which is basically 6 Saudi Arabians. They also said that what they found was this is the profile of a typical large oil field. It takes about 6 to 7 years to repeat. You have an undulating plateau for the next decade, and then you have a decline rate that has an implied rate of 2% per annum. The problem with this graph is I can't find a single producing field in all the data I look at that looks anything like this. Here's basically the decline rate of a series of deep water fields in the Gulf of Mexico. Look, for instance, at Baldpate, which is a field that came on in 1998. It reached a peak in 2000 at 50,000 barrels a day, and it's down basically to 5,000 barrels a day today. Or Hoover, which basically got to 40, and a little over 40,000 barrels a day by 2002, and is now down below 10,000 barrels a day. The Gulf of Mexico deep water fields all look like this. And so I just say, where is this modest decline? It got so ballyhooed a couple of weeks ago, and even if it was that modest, it's still a rate we can't address. So here you have just a few more deep water Gulf of Mexico production profiles to look at. Magnolia does have an undulating plateau, but it lasts for a year and a half. Ram Powell was probably the single biggest field to come on stream in 1998, a big shale project. It was designed to produce 60,000 barrels a day. It never got there. Its maximum was 45,000 barrels a day, and it stayed there for about 6 months, and it's down now to 8,000 barrels a day 7 years later. Look at Troika. You see any undulating plateau or oregano or Angus? There are now finally a growing number of major voices coming out of big oil that are starting to basically leave the optimist club, and as the media picked up, join the pessimist club. The most prominent of which happened on the 27th of January when Jeroen van der Veer, the new CEO of Shell Oil Company, sent an email to all of the worldwide employees of Shell Oil Company saying that in his estimate, that after his and Shell's estimate, that after 2015, supplies of easy-to-access oil and gas will no longer keep up with demand. And what he then said is that the world needs to take one of two possible routes. One scenario, Shell is calling scramble. And this is his words, it resembles a race through a mountainous desert. fierce competition, unintended consequences of more haste, and many will crash along the way. Then he says the other scenario is what he calls blueprint. Some false starts to develop a road still under construction. And the arrival depends on discipline, ingenuity, and technical innovation. And then he said, regardless of which route we choose, we have limited room to maneuver. What's astonishing about this is that only 6 months ago, Shell was as optimistic and vocal as some of their sister big oil companies that we have no problems. But obviously, they've finally done their homework. So, if you basically sort of go back to where we are today, when I graduated from Harvard Business School in 1967, we had one of the worst courses I've ever taken called Decision Making Under Uncertain. It's called MERC 1. We had to do all year case studies and use these decision trees. So, okay, one path goes this way, another path goes that way, another path, and then come up with Monte Carlo simulation, which I never forget what that was, to basically come up with probabilities. But say, here we are in January 2008. We're using 86, maybe 88 name barrels a day with this cold weather. And one leg of the decision tree is supply meets the IEA's forecast demand of 120 million barrels a day by 2030. A second path is that supply undulates at the current level. A third path is supply declines by round up 4.5% to 5 per annum. And then the fourth path is supply declines by 10% per annum. The case for peak oil is not perfect, but solid. Let me just go back to that and yeah, I thought I had a slide for this. If I were coming up with odds of this, I would basically put the odds on the top path at somewhere less than 0.001%. Nothing's impossible. But this is as close to impossibility as I literally know how to get. I'd say supplies undulating at the current levels might have an odds of 35%. Supply declining by 5% might have odds of 35%. But unfortunately, that leaves the draconian path at another 35%. Anytime you're in that sort of a range of uncertainty, this is an issue we ought to take extremely seriously. So the case for peak oil is not perfect, but it is pretty solid. With solid global field-by-field production data, which we sorely need, peak oil timing can actually be proved. You get the top 250 producing fields and get their historical production for the last 5 years on a quarter-by-quarter basis, and a handful of analysts in a very short period of time that actually do trend lines the way reservoir engineers do on individual producing properties, and either say, relax, we have no problem, or we are in a serious ditch today. Absent this data reform, the facts are heavily weighted to peak oil, but they're not perfect, and you have to dig for them. The other side have good arguments. Non-conventional oil growth, yet to be discovered oil. That's my favorite category, and I keep reminding people that's as valuable as my yet to be earned net worth. I would hope there's not a bank in the country that would loan me a dime on my yet-to-be-earned net worth. We shouldn't be relying on oil we have yet to find. Reserve appreciation. It's a fabulous concept, but basically what we're doing with reserve appreciation is managing the tail of these fields once they've gone through massive decline. And technology recovers more oil. This firm did all the heavy lifting investment banking that kept most of the oil field technology alive in the oil field depression of the 80s. By the early 90s, it pained me to see how we were overhyping what oil field technology was doing. And I was arguing, guys, it's creating decline curves we never could envision before. Not recovering more oil in a volumetric basis, it's extending the life of some old fields after they are far past peaking. And all these arguments turn out to be terrific arguments. They're nice to listen to, but they're faith-based. I think it's time to take this out of the church and get the real data. My odds assessment, this is where I come by, I knew I had this in here, 0.11% chance on the first leg. We shouldn't even talk about the first leg, but unfortunately the demand numbers are too real. That's what the world wants to consume. Whether it's a 40% chance of undulating, a 30% chance, a 35 or a 25 doesn't matter. These are all awful odds for, in even the best case, a draconian sort of a future. So my advice to anyone is don't bet against peak oil. While many scoff at peak oil occurring in the foreseeable future, the odds are high that it will occur, and the higher we raise demand and boost supply to meet demand, and even worse, liquidate stocks to meet the gap, the higher we raise the odds that peak oil happens, and when it occurs, the declines could be swift. Mitigation to minimize chaos is complex and time-consuming. The peak oil issue, unfortunately, is not our only risk. There are two twin issues that exasperate the peak oil risk. The first is what I generically call rust. The entire oil and gas delivery system, from casing and tubing to wellheads to gathering systems to tank farms to pipelines to refineries to tankers, to all the assets of the oil service industry, are all built out of steel. And by and large, they're all now way beyond their original design life. And in the decade of or two of the oilfield depression, we cut maintenance expenditures to the bone. We have dwindling spare capacity. In fact, some would argue, and I would argue loudly, that we're kidding ourselves to say we have any spare capacity today. We have invisible oil stocks, but what is visible says they're too low. Rust poses a real threat to our oil supply. Our entire logistical system could rust away, and all of the oil service assets and drilling rigs are built from steel. Two decades of low oil prices forced minimum or no maintenance, and now it doesn't matter which aspect of the system you're looking at, we're too rusty. Being in the Twin Cities last fall for a National Trust for Historic Preservation board meeting and seeing the awful carnage of the bridge collapse just reminded me, can you imagine basically what our pipelines would look like if you could levitate them out of the ground and see some of these pipelines that were built for a 50-year design life that are now 70 years old? We haven't looked at ever. Our refinery system in the United States on average is over 80 years old. And while the refinery owners say, oh, don't worry about that, we go in and replace valves, you know, every year and heat exchangers, the core units are still pretty old and rusting away. Rebuilding the oil infrastructure will cost trillions of dollars. The IEA estimates that the cost to simply expand the infrastructure for oil and gas will cost $5 to $6 trillion to 2030. This is tiny compared with rebuilding the entire existing base. Are there supplies and personnel to even tackle this task? But reinvesting profits from high oil prices can fund the world's largest construction project, and if we don't do this task soon, we could have the double indignity of finding that we only have 65 million barrels a day coming out of the ground, but because we rusted away our infrastructure, we're only able to supply 40, because the pipelines weren't there, and the tankers weren't there, and the refineries weren't there. So this task needs to be done ASAP. We should have started on this a decade ago. Spare capacity. It's important and it's reality. The oil market must maintain safe cushion of spare capacity. As anyone studying demand should know, demand growth can be fickle. You get 3 weeks of cold weather in the northern hemisphere and you get a bump in oil demand of 1 million barrels a day. Supply can be interrupted by acts of God. It's not just, you know, physical shutdowns. We could have an earthquake tomorrow morning and find that in Alaska, which is earthquake prone, and find out that we basically destroyed the Alaskan pipeline. And gone is basically, you know, now less than 1 million barrels a day of our important oil. The logistics of getting oil from a limited number of great oil fields and a limited number of refineries to all around the world is a long, thin line. And basically, we need a lot of spare inventory to basically be the line pack for that field. The world used to routinely have 6 to 8% spare capacity. We used to worry in the 80s that we maybe had 15% spare capacity. Would we ever live off the glut? Today's spare capacity is hopefully 2 to 3 million barrels a day, or 3%. But virtually all of this spare capacity is in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, who loudly pronounce that they have sustained capacity of 11.3 million barrels a day, and they report that they produce 8.8 million barrels a day by the end of last year, so that's the 2.5 million that everyone gets so confident in. There is no proof that this spare capacity is real. 3 weeks ago today, President Bush was in Saudi Arabia. I think the third time that a president of the United States has ever been in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And he very pointedly, there was a lot of media about this, asked the Saudi petroleum minister, we need a lot more oil on the market to dampen these oil prices. They're starting to hurt the economy. And he was basically brushed off saying, no, we don't need more oil. The markets are well served. That night, he was interviewed on Ted Koppel's Nightline with one of the reporters from Riyadh. And basically, the reporter criticized President Bush for not being tougher on the Saudis and said, you should have just given us more oil. I thought it was interesting. He said, if they, Saudi Arabia, don't have a lot of additional oil to put on the market, it's hard to ask them to do something they might not be able to do. I suspect, finally, our government at the highest levels has finally discovered there is no spare capacity in Saudi Arabia. The IEA produces in their oil monthly report a very key table. It's called Table 6, right at the end of this big thick report. This is sort of the green book, or the beige book to the oil markets. And basically, this shows all of the imports of oil by key countries into the member countries of the International Energy Agency. And the very first three columns are Saudi Arabian light and extra light oil, Saudi Arabian medium oil, and Saudi Arabian crude oil, and then they break them out by North America, Europe, and the Pacific. If you take this data and add them up, and you go back and look, Saudi Arabia imported to member countries of the IEA 4.61 million barrels a day of oil in 2003. It jumped to 4.46 in 2004, and they dropped, to 4.46. They jumped back a little to 4.53 in 2005, to 4.45 in 2006, and this is the first three quarters of 2007. 3.87 million barrels a day, 3.96, and 3.94. If they were sitting on 2 to 3 million barrels of spare capacity with oil prices between $80 and $100 a barrel, those numbers would go up. In the most current data, basically in October, that number has now dropped to 3.6 million barrels a day, which is the lowest in over a decade. And yet, so many people in the world assume, blissfully assume because they say they do, that we're basically have this spare capacity. Is the dip in Saudi Arabian exports an aberration? Well, basically, they would argue that. But I basically look at three projects. Katif that came on in 2005 at 500,000 barrels a day, Abu Safa that came on at 150,000 barrels a day, Increment 3 at the foot of Ghawar at 300,000 barrels a day. They have brought 950,000 barrels a day of new oil on the market. And occasionally you basically hear someone say, most of this oil is to replace declines from our mature fields. Well, the problem is all our fields are mature. When spare capacity around the world is gone, then Houston, we have a problem of the highest order. Since random events can decrease daily supply by significant amounts. 10 days ago, we had snow and bitter cold in Alberta, and it shut down most 350,000 days from the Canadian tar sands. They just can't operate in bitter cold weather. For the last 2 months, there's been continuous unrest in the Niger Delta. That's 400,000 to 600,000 barrels a day. On my emails coming in this morning before I left Houston, I saw the Nigerian petroleum minister say that Nigeria now has 1 million barrels a day of shut-in supply, and only half of that coming from political unrest. I have no idea what the rest is all about. North Sea storms can shut down 500,000 to 1 million barrels a day for a week or two. Canarel's unexpected decline is going to drop 200,000 barrels a day this year. So to go with no excess capacity, we can't bring oil fields on that fast. Good news in random events can bump seasonal oil demand also. Cold weather in the Northern Hemisphere, you get a bump of 500,000 to 1 million barrels a day more demand. Or unexpected growth in auto travel, 300,000 to 500,000 barrels a day more demand. And so if we're basically out of spare capacity and you can't bring on fuels very fast, then oil stock liquidation is the last firewall between a market well served and the awful fear of shortages. Shortages of oil, if they ever occur again, we have a lot of data about how human nature behaves from 1973 and 1960 and 79. As soon as there's a whiff of shortages, then consumers and retail suppliers top up their tank and hoard, and that's when scarcity occurs. The motorists in the United States, according to occasional studies done by the Automobile Association, drive their cars on average with about a third of the tank full. The motorists of the United States suddenly topping up their tank would, in my opinion, probably drain our gasoline pool in the United States once and for all in maybe a matter of less than a week. We have 170,000 service stations in the United States. They operate generally with about 40 to 50% of their tanks under the service station full. So if of a shortage, they all top up their tanks. And the double whammy is within days, we run dry. That sounds like a Stephen King novel, but let me remind you all that when Houston, Texas, right in the heart of the refinery belt, had to evacuate because of Hurricane Rita bearing down in Houston, we ran totally out of gasoline in 4 hours. It can happen. Lake Charles refinery, Exxon's biggest refinery in the United States, after Katrina, Lake Charles didn't get hit. So basically, it left them with 4 hours left of usable crude, so they applied to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve for emergency oil. So we operate our system on a real lean supply anyway, and we just could never basically stand a run in the bank. What our oil stock data...
Excuse me, Mr. Simmons. Because our normal capacity for recording is out of order today, we are... We have a sort of auxiliary system here, and we need to take a slight break so we can make a technical upgrade.
Cool.
So take this opportunity to get a drink of water, and we'll be ready to go in just a minute.
Okay. I just looked over and I was like, hey.
We'll have to see what he wants to do. I can reach him right now. He doesn't go on his cell phone right now. He doesn't go on until he can call his cell phone right now. Ask him what he wants to do quick.
Are we ready?
Yeah.
They're in your pack? Oh, I don't know. Well, there's probably some in unopened packets here, too. People that didn't show up previously because they have one that's not going to be here.
Really?
Well, be able to find where kind of skip it, you know?
I remember his interview.
Yeah, you can just speak.
How often did that come out? Once a week or
half? Well.
Yeah.
Let's
get one. Okay.
There you go. 713-546-7214. Mr. Simmons, thank you for your patience. I hope you were able to take advantage of that little break. It didn't seem like you got much of a chance to, but I think we're ready to go.
Okay, great. I'm almost at the end, so And then several people asked before, they said, I'm perfectly happy to answer questions for as long as any of you want, or hear comments from any of you. What do our oil stocks show us from the best data we have? Well, the Energy Information Administration publishes every Wednesday morning the weekly U.S. petroleum stock report on crude and finished products. The detailed data is reported by regions, but it's based on a voluntary sampling in some scattered locations. There's no mandatory fine if the companies that are being sampled don't actually take the physical measurement. And I don't think there's any evidence that every one of those reports actually went out at 7 a.m. on a Friday morning, which is theoretically your measuring point, and dropped the dip stink into a tank farm, which is really the only way you'd ever know. But basically, this data comes into the EIA by email, and then feverishly Monday afternoon and Tuesday, the EIA computer modelers gather it all up and gross it up to represent a proxy for the entire United States. It's only a collection in the sampling of what we call primary stocks, which is vats of oil, pipelines, tank farms, and terminals that store over 50,000 barrels of oil plus. We have no data on all the smaller supplies of oil. We have no data on secondary stocks or tertiary stocks. Secondary stock is what basically the wholesale distribution system holds. Retail stocks are the servicing. Retail stocks are how much the motorists and gasoline have in their tanks. The International Energy Agency publishes OECD stock data. It lags by about 3 months. But basically, it basically covers the reporting for the OECD countries, and most of them have almost no data collection, so it's just estimates of what the stock is. And outside the OECD, there's some estimates of Singapore's oil stocks. There's starting to be some estimates of China's oil stocks, which are basically almost none. They don't have any system, but they're growing so fast that they don't have any spare way to store oil. So we don't have any idea how much oil is at sea. We don't have any idea how much oil is in transit in the Bahamas and so forth. We have no idea, period. Will we ever know when a crisis is at hand? With no reliable data on the 250 key producing oil fields, is their production growing, flat, or in decline? On the average decline rates by region, on skimpy stock data, on media guesses at what most key oil countries produce, and global natural gas data is far worse than oil, and global natural gas, which I haven't really discussed, could be in way worse shape than oil. We have no early warning system. The dew system was put in across the top of Canada and the Arctic back in the 50s as the only device we would have to see missiles coming early enough to do something about it. We don't have a dew system in any aspect of our oil system. Say, man alive, the missiles have been launched. We are basically now headed towards an energy war. We have no radar screen to see the marching enemy approaching. If you go back to the history of World War II and the tragedy of Pearl Harbor, which began with four months before that, the United States accidentally deciding to embargo Japan from all U.S. goods to try to force them into being more user-friendly to China. 80% of Japan's oil was coming from imports to the United States. And so they immediately said, we've got to invade Southeast Asia. And they quickly realized that invading Southeast Asia, if they didn't knock out the Pacific Fleet, which was all tightly, anchored in Pearl Harbor, they basically would last about 3 weeks conquering Southeast Asia. So they basically sent the largest squadron of planes ever across the Pacific. And we had a radar system in. Just that the people that saw the blip thought there couldn't be that many planes. It must be an error in the system. So even when we have a system in place, we don't necessarily ever see the signs. But what's dangerous today is we have no dew system. We have no radar system. We have no data. We're basically flying blind. How fast could a crisis erupt? Well, a series of unseen events could happen at any time. This is just a handful of events I just thought off the top of my head on Friday. Bitter cold Asian weather. Why did I think of that? Because China's having the worst winter it's had in 50 years. The Bosphorus sea freezes up. Why do I think of that? Because it's record cold weather in Turkey right now. Bosphorus sea freezes up, you lose all the Russian exports, about 1 million barrels a day that come out of Russia. A tanker explosion happens in the Malacca Straits. Where are the Malacca Straits? They're this unbelievable lifeline going between about 50 miles east of Singapore and 40 miles west of Singapore, where it's so shallow at low tide, and I didn't think they had tides. They don't have big tides like we have in Maine. But basically the tankers have to anchor up at both ends of the Malacca Strait until the tide comes back to mean tide so they can stream through. There's 11 to 12 million barrels a day of oil coming from the Middle East to feed oil needs in Hong Kong, China, Korea, Japan. One tanker explosion in the Malacca Strait, or accident, and you shut the straits down for some unforeseeable period of time. Earthquake damage in the Alaska pipeline. A terrorist attack on the Abqaiq oil processing plant. What is the Abqaiq oil processing plant? It's about 5 by 5 kilometers. It has about 4 series of high chain link fences to kind of guard it. It's basically where every barrel of light and extra light oil that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia produces is sent to strip out the water and the gas and the sour products so it becomes usable oil. One terrorist attack in Abqaiq and it could go up in flames. Is that an impossibility? So far, the security forces of Saudi Arabia have stopped at least 3 visible attacks, terrorist attacks, on Abqaiq. And so it's sitting there like a duck. At some point, they're going to get through. A sudden surge in oil demand turns out to be just as dangerous as any of these sort of unforeseen events. And one or two of these bugs could be the tipping point to totally change the way we live, and it would only take a few weeks before a usable finished product tank ran dry. How long would it take us to recover? When the tanks are dry, the refilling requires the system to shut down for weeks or even months. I don't know how we do that. I mean, I know after World War II started in earnest, we shut the United States down other than oil for the military needs, and I guess we'd have to do the same thing. When transportation ends, dwindling food supplies are ironically the single biggest risk because too much of our food comes from long distances, totally relying on oil as a transportation fuel and other energy as a preservative in refrigeration that doesn't arrive rotten. And without energy, basically, you'd have a matter of weeks before our shelves are dry of food. Hospital businesses all have to revert to skeleton operations, and stranded travelers create chaos. Again, looking at the news in China, where all these millions of travelers are trying to get home for Chinese New Year, basically they can't because of snow. It sort of gives you a peek as to how chaotic the world we could barrel into so quickly and so out of the blue could be. If oil peaks too, then a full recovery would be impossible. So all we could do is basically mitigate against further chaos. Mitigating this disaster is not easy. Mandated data reform, in my opinion, is priority number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Field-by-field quarterly production report should be mandatory. Seems to me it would be so easy for the OECD or the member countries of the IEA to basically say anybody, whether it's a country or a company, that wants to import oil outside their own internal system into the OECD member countries has to either furnish production reports or pay a $20 a barrel fancy fine. And I would guarantee you within about a month that day would be forthcoming because this would be a lot of money. And for the people that wanted to pay the fine, great, we could use the money for trying to build up some firewalls to protect this. The crash testing of global oil stocks. We should basically have a better measurement of how much oil inventory we have on hand. If you had to basically put a team of 1,000 auditors in the field and say, by the end of this month, let's know, that would be a lot better than basically flying blind. Resolve when stocks hit minimum operating levels. We see these numbers that come out every week by the EIA. You see that we have 280 million barrels of crude. You say, man, a lot of that's a lot of crude. Included in all those barrels are all the oil that basically is in tankers that come into the Gulf of Mexico and all the pipelines that basically take oil from the loop, which is the only way we have to receive extra large tankers in the Gulf and take them all the way up the Capline pipeline to Paducah, Illinois, and then it fans out all across the Midwest. All of that oil is in the 300 million barrels. All of the oil at the refineries is in that 300 million barrels. So most of that oil is unusable. And when you finally drop down to what the industry calls NINOF, which we don't even know where it is, then you start robbing Peter to pay Paul. There's a lot of signs that we've been robbing Peter to pay Paul over the last 9 months as we've sort of lurched from our heating stocks are too low, our gasoline stocks are too low. Now we've filled them up and our crude stocks are too low. So I think we're in the end game of this massive inventory liquidation that came to meet when demand exceeded supply. How do we begin a retreat from our addiction to oil? Well, once we have data reform, the data, I think, would be so clear that you could have with some clarity how serious this issue is, and then the leaders of the world could conduct a global energy summit for all key producing and consuming countries, the way we did after World War II in San Francisco to the United Nations, the way we did when we realized that Europe was destroyed in World War II, so we created the Marshall Plan. the way we did with the Manhattan Project Square, to basically say we have to invent some new forms of energy for transportation. But unless you address such a thing on a global basis, we're whistling past the cemetery. What does not work? Unfortunately, in peak oil, what doesn't work is other supplies. Nuclear is going to have to play a very important role in the energy grid in the future, but nuclear creates electricity, and it's very water intensive. Electricity will never address transportation, not in our lifetimes. Coal to liquids. It's a technology that the Nazis basically perfected in World War II. The problem is, as they found out, they had abundant coal, but what they didn't get is basically much oil, which is why they had to turn and invade Russia to capture their oil fields, as they realized they were going to end up fuel. So to rely, to take some of these projects on the drawing board of taking enough coal to run a 1,000 megawatt coal plant and turning it into 12 to 15,000 barrels of high-quality diesel shouldn't be done. It's wasting too much coal. Solar and wind work today. The economics of wind is actually very competitive. Solar still needs some technology breakthroughs on the economics, but it works. But they create electricity, and that's not oil. And it doesn't address at all our transportation problems. And I can't believe how many times when I do hear people saying, well, peak oil might be real, but what we need is more nuclear, more wind, more solar. And I say, no, that doesn't have any relevance to peak oil. Peak oil is transportation. Non-conventional oil, very real. Canada really does have the same amount, we think, they're just volumetric estimates, of heavy oil sands and tar sands as Saudi Arabia has oil. The difference is what Saudi Arabia had at its peak. In North Ghawar, largest oil field in the world, in the top 25 miles at its peak, they produced 5 million barrels a day, with a handful of wells that are producing 40 to 50,000 barrels a well. Shell Oil Company has a project north of Edmonton to expand one of their big oil sands plants by 100,000 barrels a day, and they started 3 years ago thinking it would cost $3 to $4 billion. Now the estimates are up to $14 billion, about 5 years, to create 100,000 barrels a day incremental heavy oil. And what you end up creating basically is low quality oil, and you've used up an enormous amount of natural gas and potable water to do it. So it's just a low quality source of trying to substitute for extremely high quality white flowing crude. So basically, if we don't have a supply solution, and oil is peaking, we have to address the only real solution. How do we use less oil? And substitution by other energy sources is unlikely. A new car fleet can happen, but it will take years to affect. And since we have in the United States 280 million vehicles, and since we have around the world almost 900 million vehicles, it almost doesn't matter how fast we create a new car fleet. Implementing the turnover is so utterly long that it doesn't make a dent in the problem. So the only viable solution that can work today in the next 5 to 7 years is travel less. What travel less means is less long distance commuting, growing foods at home, making goods locally. It's not terribly complicated. How do we travel less? Well, the single best solution came ironically from Bill White, who's the mayor of Houston, and then he forgot about it. Because Mayor White called me about 2 weeks ago, and he said, you know, with the energy heating up, and since Bill used to be the chief operating officer at the Department of Energy in the first 3 years of the Clinton administration, he's now just got reelected with 92% of the vote as his third term of mayor of Houston. And about 3 years ago, he said, you know, Houston can't expand its freeway system anymore. We've just done the most costly expansion ever, and the next round would break us. We have to address peak travel. And he thought about it for about a month, and he said, all we have to do is liberate the workforce. Pay by productivity. And then let people decide when they want to work and where they want to work, and long distance commuting will end. Well, that's the software problem. We really don't have a software system today that allows companies to monitor productivity. If Bill Gates can create Microsoft, we can solve that problem. Let the most productive people earn the most and let them work wherever they want to work. And basically, they need to ship goods and people, as efficiently as possible. In the distribution choices, trains always trump trucks when they work. Too many of our trains are on single tracks. They're all at cycling, waiting for another train to come by, so we need to rebuild our track system. And then water. Transportation over water beats trains hands down. There's some studies that have been done, and they're sort of skimpy studies, but in magnitude, they're important, showing the difference between taking a cargo ship coming in from China to San Diego, and on the cargo ship, a hypothetical 340 units of cargo, that basically have one or three ways of getting to Portland, Maine. They're all going to northern New England. So Portland, Maine is the hub you're trying to reach. You can put them on 340 trucks, semi-trucks, and basically send them across the United States. And so the semi-trucks get 3 to 7 miles per gallon. And they basically, because the trucks stop and start at every sort of place they take things, so it takes about 25 days to get there. You can put them on a train. If we had a dedicated track, you could get there in about 5 days at about 150 amount of fuel. But we don't have a dedicated track, so it takes about 25 days. And most of the time, they're off on a sidecar waiting idle. Or you could put them in a technology we have today in the barge system. It's called a six-pack. It's 3 wide, 6 long, strapped together, pushed by 11,500 horsepower tug down through the Panama Canal, hug the intercoastal waterway, cross the Panama of Florida, come up the intercoastal waterway. You're in Portland, Maine in 12 to 13 days at 1/35th the amount of oil used. So we need to be very careful about how we transport people and goods. And then finally, we need to grow food locally. I don't know when this happened, but it was after I graduated from high school about 45 years ago. Back then, you couldn't go in grocery stores, at least in Utah, or when I went back to Boston to business school, and find in the late fall, winter, and spring, and early summer, fresh goods available and meat from around the world. But somehow, in the passage of one generation, we got used to basically having goods shipped all around the world that have embedded in them food miles that are unbelievable. And unfortunately, the food doesn't taste any good. It's so, these little things we used to call peaches are so hard, you can hardly cut them with a knife. Well, we're going to go back to having to grow food locally, and guess what? It tastes good. Biggest revolution in food today are the Whole Foods and the central markets of the world who have discovered it. Basically, these and farmers markets. Houston now has 6 farmers markets that operate year-round. They're terrific. That can happen unbelievably fast. If we end long-distance commuting, people can actually go home and grow a victory garden in their backyard, which we used to do in World War II. And then finally, we can end globalized manufacture of parts. This whole move to globalization, one of the screwiest aspects of it was the concept that you could take a manufactured unit like a water gun or a carburetor of a car and break it into very simple pieces and then fan them out around the world and find a sweatshop economy where there's still someone that's willing to work for 50 cents a day and basically create cheap goods. The problem with that is as we zing the goods all around the world as parts, we were using up too much energy, and the guy working for 50 cents a day was unhappy. That was just as unsustainable as 100 years ago when we had our textile mills and factories filled with street urchins, and it wasn't going to work. So we had to get used to basically producing goods where they're used. And that will, again, start to really reduce our energy intensity of how we use oil. Solving peak oil, unfortunately, doesn't start at home. One of the most common questions as I give these various energy talks around the country is, what can I personally do? And sadly, you can clamor for data reform, and that's getting your elected officials. They pass a law. But individually, it is very hard, basically, to do a series of things that really make a big difference. Because to make a big difference, you have to have a really coordinated regional solution, and then regional solutions won't work. It has to be a global solution. And it's dangerous to basically create a bunch of feel-good things, because if you do enough of that, people will think they've solved the problem, when in fact they're probably not even starting to address the problem. Solving peak oil dilemma is a global issue. It needs the international cooperation on the scale of the Marshall Plan. China and India and other countries like them must be at the table, and oil transparency must be mandated as soon as possible. But all these solutions will still take time. I just think if we started now, probably in 5 to 7 years, we could have a real dent on reducing our enormous intensity of how we use oil. Are there long-term new supplies that are going to work? Well, I hope so, but we don't know what they are today. The world needs to create usable new energy sources. But to be usable, they need to meet the following tests. They need to be a skill to be relevant. So a 15,000 barrel a day total liquid refinery isn't at a skill to be relevant. They need to be non-energy intensive to produce. So turning to ethanol from corn as a biofuel and then realizing that you're using probably quite a bit more energy to create the corn ethanol and create a low-quality energy product to boot. But that was basically a bad idea. So we have to go to methods of new energy that are non-energy intensive or not go there. They need to be available on a global basis. And about 60% of the people on Earth live within about 50 miles of our oceans. And so that gives you some idea of where they need to be located. The candidates that could work are skimpy. Solar in space, there's been a limited amount of work that has looked at the prospect of putting solar panels on satellites or on the moon and beaming down to the Gobi Desert, the Mojave Desert, the big solar panels that aren't a roof size. They're like 10 kilometers by 10 kilometers and then using super connectivity. Again, it doesn't solve peak oil, but it might work. I don't think we know anything yet about the real potentials for geothermal, basically tapping the mantle of the Earth, other than the few applications we see steam coming out of the Earth or a hot spring to say there must be hot rocks down there. Hopefully there'll be some non-agricultural biofuels that aren't energy intensely produced that really can start to produce a high-quality transportation fuel that starts substituting in scale for oil. And then what I'm most excited about, and it's still a pipe dream, is a variety of energy sources creating from our oceans. So let me end with basically just commenting about one of the real sleepers over the horizon, ocean energy. Our oceans cover 70% of the globe. So the one thing we're never going to run out of is seawater. Our water, we know from past experience, from ugly experience, is a very powerful force. Our hurricanes, the typhoons we have, when water gets up, you compress water, it's really worse than getting hit by concrete. The possibilities for ocean energy are vast. Tides, waves, current, ocean thermal energy conversion. There's someone here that basically been involved in OTEC in Hawaii. It's been we have a 20-year experience, maybe 25-year experience, but it was always so costly that basically it was over the horizon because we're trying to compete against free electricity. Aquatic biofuels. We know almost nothing about all of the vast amounts of sea life that we've discovered in the last 15 years that exists below life in the ocean. We don't know why they're there. We don't know how big they are. We don't know how they're produced. But the best, most promising work being done at the DOE right now on biofuels is algae. But they're talking about growing algae in the desert because it reproduces so fast. And fish. Don't miss aquatic biofuels in the ocean. Seeps and vents, that's probably where the forests come from, is our seeps and vents, because Cantrell wasn't the only oil field. It was so thick and gooey that the fishermen found it. We should know more about that. We should find a way to capture it, because that's probably some of our worst emission problems of CO2 are coming in seeps and vents in our ocean. Hydrates, which are basically frozen gas, methane, coming out of fractures that apparently litter the Arctic floor. But the problem is hydrates right now are a net loser. When they get into a pipeline, they rip it apart. If we could ever figure out how to capture that, we might have solved our natural gas problems. The study of ocean energy across the board is where offshore oil and gas was in the early 1950s. It is just barely understood and barely begun. And there are only a few identified ocean energy experts. Could ocean energy be a holy grail? Well, since 60% of humanity live within 50 miles of the ocean at scale, we know more about the surface of Mars than the regions below the surface of our ocean. And that's wrong. Ocean thermal energy conversion can actually go beyond creating electricity. It can create ultimately ammonia. And there are some people that say that ammonia could be a very viable replacement for motor gasoline. Algae family seems to be very promising, and seeps create vast ocean pollution today. We ought to capture them and use them. So the world in a post-peak oil era is, in my opinion, a pretty simple path. We have to decide which road we take. We can either turn up towards spatial chaos, and ironically, I created this about 3 weeks before I read the Shell Oil Company scramble or blueprint, and it's sort of the same kind of path, or reshape our society. And reshaping our society is massive energy efficiency and a Manhattan Project to create new energy sources. Energy data reform would end peak oil debate, and we, the world, have the ability to choose which path we take. Thank you. Thank you. For any of you that are curious, this happens to be twilight in the desert in Chinese, in German, in Japanese, and in Korean.
In which countries they're probably paying a lot more attention.
I think they are.
Questions from members? Representative Brainerd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've given us more to think about than I can absorb in this 2 hours, but I have a couple of questions. We're obviously coming from a state policy level. You've said the issue is a global issue, you know, and we can't tackle it locally. Well, we're somewhere in the middle, and sometimes saying it's a global issue or a national issue is simply a way of stalling action, and then states don't act because that's not their purview or power. Do you see any ways that policymakers at the state level can affect, for instance, the data reform effort? Are there things we can do from this position? Clearly, we can do things about conservation, about research and development.
Yes. Sure. And when I said you can't do it at home, what I was really addressing is, you know, a young family saying, gosh, what can I do? do my to do my part. And that's where you have to say it's too big for a group of individuals. But I think for regional communities, and states are a perfect description of what regional communities are, by addressing the issue on a statewide basis and educating your population, it does two things. It gets a whole bunch of people in a unit that basically is small enough you can communicate to understand the issue, and also you become a role model for the other 49 states, most of whom haven't even thought about this. And there are some individual things. I mean, your state could basically go on some of my conservation plans, suggestions, and liberate your workforce and go on a local food program and so forth and be a test tube for how well this works. Now, if a small village does that, it would be misleading, because it's easy for a small village to do, but a state the size of Minnesota, putting in plan a form that you can prove it works could be an unbelievably important thing. But I think there's a lot of things that can be done at the state level, and I really applaud the education I've gotten about how much work's gone on in Minnesota. This is kind of a counterintuitive area to think this would be worth it. But you know what? I spoke in New Hampshire last spring at the University of New Hampshire. There was the community center was packed with about 500 people. They have a graduate course at UNH called Peak Oil. I found there was more knowledge about peak oil in New Hampshire than there was in the state of Texas.
Thank you, Representative Barry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a bunch of questions, but maybe I'll just hit one and see where we go. I think the editors at The Economist would probably say, well, if supply goes down, then price goes up, and therefore rational actors in the marketplace therefore take action to compensate for that, seek alternatives, substitutes, and so on. But that sort of assumes that the change is incremental enough that you can adjust, sort of like a leaking balloon that's leaking a little bit of air out versus a bubble that bursts all at once.
Yeah.
Which scenario are we looking at? A leaking balloon where you've got fields that are kind of at different levels in different places at different times, where you can kind of project things, or are we talking about a bubble that's about to burst?
Well, I think when you basically just look at the fierce nature of some of those decline profiles that I showed you, those are real fields. Those are important fields. That's not a leaking of a balloon. It's maybe not as dramatic as a popular balloon, but it's certainly like, you know, rolling a carton of Easter eggs over a cliff. And so I think that that this could happen a lot faster than and you know, the argument that you raise about the Economist is so true. There are so many people that I hear say, you know what, price cures all ills. And this is sort of what I call the invisible hand of Adam Smith. That somehow or another, we see the price rise starts to dampen demand, it brings on more supply, and it brings on new alternatives, and we go happily thereafter into new era. And I basically just keep raising the fact that, first of all, I grew up in a banking family in Utah, and basically I've been an investment banker for 40 years. I know how the free markets work. They're grossly inefficient. They punish gluts and so forth, and so. But you basically, you know, and also, we have a lot of evidence that the price rose tenfold and it didn't hurt demand. As I was telling someone earlier, I was in, my wife and I went over to East Africa to pick up our youngest daughter who is studying in this fall in Kenya, and I watched with amazement around Greater Nairobi for 2 days, Nairobi was still a peaceful city. They were paying $8 a gallon or $7.50 a gallon for dirty diesel, and their traffic congestion was worse than the Katy Freeway in Houston. In London, this late October, I was there for a conference, and we were in this unbelievable traffic jam going out to the airport, and I asked the driver, I said, out of curiosity, what do you pay for your petrol? And it took the two of us together about 5 minutes to convert pounds into dollars and liters into gallons. He said, I guess about $9 a gallon. Does it really impact your traffic system? So I don't think that basically there's any evidence that price could go way up from here and Adam Smith's invisible hand would do anything to choke it.
Representative Gardner, do you have a follow-up?
I think they had a follow-up question. You weren't here for the mining hearing we had about 2 weeks ago, but I discovered that when I ask a question, the person who answers it gets to be on TV that night. So, here you go. I'm just curious what, we're looking at something like raising a gas tax for infrastructure, but for other reasons, and I'm just curious what you think the elasticity of demand is for petroleum when you apply a tax on the end user. Smile for Kim.
I don't think, other than sticker shock, that it will make a big difference, because it hasn't in other parts of the world. Now, I think probably in benefit of hindsight, it was a terrible mistake that we didn't follow the lead of Europe and a lot of other countries and put an enormous BTU tax on gasoline, because the consumer paid for it. But today, the problem with doing that is I think we create a new generation of people that would think for 5 or 10 years, the only reason motor gasoline is now $6 a barrel is that damn tax. As opposed to the fact that, no, we basically have a different problem going on. So I think there's no evidence. I mean, it would raise a lot of money, and we're going to have a lot of money to rebuild the infrastructure. But I come back and say that's the beauty of high oil prices, that you got to, maybe the government's going to have to tax the money away to make sure it's spent on rebuilding the industry.
Thanks. You'll get on YouTube anyway, I think.
Other questions? Representative Virginia.
Thank you. First, thanks for coming here. We really appreciate, or I certainly appreciate, this education. You talked about Shell Oil and their willingness to tell the public, essentially, what they found. I can't imagine that the rest of the big oil doesn't know what Shell knows. Am I wrong about that? And what is their motivation for being silent at this point?
You know, Mr. all I can tell you is that I've had some pretty sharp arguments with some of the leadership of their major oil companies, and they think that I basically am just over the top and an alarmist and so forth, and I can't believe that they don't understand what I know. So I don't think that they actually know. When the National Petroleum Council was asked to do this massive study on peak oil by Secretary Bodden, first of all, they almost froze at the mention of the term peak oil. And they geared up and did the most unbelievable overkill of people working on this. But until two-thirds of the way through the 1,500-person task force they put together, that they finally got around to 2 days of hearings of interviewing this small group of 8 peak oil alarmists. And it was amazing. They basically suddenly came to the realization after 1 day of hearing the first panel, oh my gosh, these guys are talking about flow rates. I thought they were talking about the remaining usable resource base. And I said, these are smart people. So I don't think they actually do know. I don't know what got into the epiphany of Shell CEO. I bless him for doing that. But, you know, maybe it was basically the fact that for the last 4 or 5 years, all the major oil companies have had this unbelievable struggle trying to keep their own production base flat. Exxon, in reporting the world's largest profits ever, also reported that their year-over-year barrel of oil equivalent production grew by 1% last year, which is 40,000 barrels a day. And then they said, had it not been for nationalization of Venezuela, a few divestitures, the high prices, the higher the price goes, the less oil they can record in a lot of these foreign countries, we would have grown by 3% a year. That's 120,000 barrels a day for a company with a 4.2 million barrel of oil and gas equivalent production base. Why they don't think they have a problem, I don't know, but they don't believe they have a problem.
Can I follow up on that?
Certainly, Representative Wicking.
I understand everything you have, not understand it, but I believe what you've told us today. But this notion that they don't know, I just cannot believe that. I mean, we have a major corporation here, Northwest Airlines. For years, they have known how many cupfuls more, whatever they use, jet fuel, it takes to fly from here to Miami than from Miami here. I mean, they've got their fuel down to that.
Yeah.
And their economists know exactly how to do pricing because of that. It just I just cannot believe that the rest of big oil does not know.
Well, all I can tell you is that there are three or four of my compatriots, that tend to be people I didn't know 5 years ago, that are all like soldiers in arms on this issue. And one of the best is a guy named Dr. Herman Franson. And Herman got his PhD at Fletcher School at Tufts about the same time I was at Harvard. And then he volunteered on the Hill to go into Swoop Jackson's investigation after the 73 oil thing. That's the guy to get intrigued with oil. He spent five years as the chief economist of the IEA. He spent 12 years as an advisor of the Oman Petroleum Minister. Herman has told me many times, he said, until you and I became friends and you started giving me all this data, I was as dumb as the rest of them. And Herman's the one that loves it because he's got a lot of stature within the energy economist community. And he basically just, preaches, he says, get the stuff out of the church. All these beliefs don't work. And, you know, they kind of say, well, what's wrong with Herman? He spent too much time with Matt Simmons. It's hard to believe, but you know what? I watch General Motors, for instance. They're an enormously large company. They're a big company, and they doubled down on the Hummer on a belief that basically, people wanted larger and larger cars, and oil prices would never go up because they listened to big oil. So there is a sense of insularity with a company. You talk to the heads of the small, medium-sized independents, and we're all talking out of the same book, but you get into the senior corporate executive suites of big oil, and they have really basically believed, as opposed to don't tell anybody, that we don't have any problems.
Mr. Simmons, I have a number of questions. I don't want to throw them all at you at once, but this seems kind of relevant to where the discussion has gone. And that goes back to your observation about the vast amount of money that it would take to rebuild the infrastructure in all the ways that you described, and wondering what your thoughts are about why that isn't happening and what could cause it to happen.
Well, it's pretty easy, in my view, to see why it isn't happening. Is it for virtually 30 years, the industry was suffering in a very low price environment, and they had to cut things to the bone. And the last thing they ever thought about, this happens in any, you take a person that basically loses his job, and what you do, he stops maintaining his car, and his house gets run down. It's when you don't have the money. But they ineffectively started pretending that, oh, with our new inspection programs, we don't, and also, our system's almost new. And when this rust issue finally hit the radar screen, ironically, is in Prudhoe Bay, one of America's newest, shiniest oil field assets. And all of a sudden, some guy was walking the line in the middle of March and saw these big stains in the snow. Had it been the summer, that stuff never would have been found. And what they found within months. And BP denied that they'd done anything wrong. They said, we have a robust maintenance program, we have a robust this, we have a robust that. Well, when the investigators finally got to the bottom of it, that line had not been pegged, which is the only way you know it's inside, for something like a decade and a half. They knew it was getting sludgier. They just didn't want to go there because they thought, if there is a problem, what will we do about it? So I do think there's an element of out of sight, out of mind. And if we have a problem in our bridges and our highway system, they are inside in mind compared to our pipelines. Literally, most of our major pipeline problems we found when something caves in. Okay, over years that's been leaking, and finally the earth just caved in. And also, the industry does a very good job of painting things. And once something's painted, the tank farms at Cushing, Oklahoma, which is for the NYMEX contract, so this is sort of the O'Hare of domestic flowing crude, where all these crude gates have to come, 21 million barrels of above-ground tank farms. And I saw a presentation by a company that wanted to expand some tank farms there, and they showed me the pictures and said, now, the 60% of these tank farms are over 60 years old. I said, over 60 years old? 20% are over 70 years old. I said, how does a tank farm, why don't they just leak? He said, oh, they do. They get painted once a year, and about 2 months later, you can see the seams. we're all, you know, but so, you know, and they didn't dare, the land they wanted to buy was way up from the tank farms, because they, if they bought south of tank farms, it would be a Superfund site because of all the leakage. So it really is out of sight, out of mind. And then we have a robust system, and don't worry about that. But there's a, you know, it's actually interesting. I happened to come across a copy of the December 1896 Scientific American, and I bought it for a totally different reason. Its cover story was on steam. I just thought it would be interesting to see what we knew and didn't know about steam energy in 1896. Second article was about steel. It was really profound. It was talking about the fact that in Scientific American then was just as prestigious in the scientific community it was today. Said that as America starts building high-rise buildings out of steel, as opposed to rock and aggregate, we're changing very profoundly because steel rusts. So the minute steel is cast, it starts rusting away. And so we're building buildings that won't be there in 150 years. And I hope we realize that these buildings basically are rusting away and actually address it, you know, fast enough. And I thought, hey, there's a great phrase in the maritime industry, rust never sleeps. And we just basically thought for 30 years that rust did sleep.
And Mr. Simmons, there was kind of a second part to that question of what could possibly cause that investment to be made.
Well,
since it is a public policy issue,
That is a public policy issue, and I think that basically what could happen, and if you look at the tanker business, we skirted around how old our tankers were for a long period of time, and two or three times we'd have a single hull old tanker just collapse. Then about 3 or 4 years ago in the Bay of Biscay, an old tanker was taking some dirty Russian oil down to Southeast Asia and was going to the scrap yard. And basically, it got off Bay of Biscay and it fell apart. It was called the Prestige. And basically, it took 2 weeks for the European Union to ban forever any more 20-year or older single-hull tankers coming to any port of the European Union. So I think that if we wait, we'll have to do it. But, you know, we've seen in the refinery business, I mean, the terrible problems BP's had with the Texas City refinery were basically, you know, they were cutting corners, but the Texas City refinery is one of these refineries that's over 80 years old, and it should have been bulldozed down and rebuilt.
Okay. Senator Carlson.
Hey, Mr. Chair and Mr. Simmons, you mentioned a couple of times the notion of mandated data reform, and what I'm thinking is as we go toward whatever the terminology is here, the oil we have or the supplies we have will get more and more precious.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I have two questions. One is, in view of what we've heard about with, for instance, the southern Iraqi fields where there isn't any monitoring going on, the meters aren't running, the meters are being bypassed. We've heard before about, you know, the Royal Tanker, you know, all of those legends. And now mandated reform, or mandated data reporting, is that even possible? And how would you see us doing it? And do you think that we're going to have more and more black market oil?
It's at least 85 to 95% of the really significant oil fields have reliable production data. In fact, it's only the exception that where there aren't any meters there, and they have the data in their office, and all we have to do is say, and if we ask for it, they won't give it to us. So what we have to do is put a fine on them. I had the ability of addressing a group of our senior military brass about a year and a half ago, one of my comments is this is a proper role for the military. You can basically send our troops in and get their data. But I don't think we have to go there. I think the fine would get you there. This is another example of where Minnesota could play a, you know, some important entities to say, we now think this is public issue number one. And there's no, data reform doesn't hurt anybody. You know, the arguments that even the major oil companies make, well, it's our oil, and it would be harmful for our commercial interests to say how much we produce with it. Give me a break. Supply chain management is basically know what your supplier has and doesn't have. So I think we could get there very easily, and I also think that the, you probably only need the top 100 producing fields in ranking, size of production to get your answer. And again, the trend is your friend. If you basically can then plot out the production, that would let us know whether we have a modest decline in front of when you aggregate it all up, or big enough decline that we don't have but a month or two left before we start getting tension.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Simmons, I do have a follow-up that's totally unrelated to the last question, but I can't help but ask it because of your background in banking. What's your perspective, and can you comment on the pricing of oil in euros as opposed to dollars?
Yeah, I don't think it actually has much relevance. Now, that's an area that I really never had any reason to do any profound, but one of the reasons high prices have been sort of a ho-hum issue in Europe is that the euro is so much higher today that they're paying in dollars. So, but I just don't think that switch would have much. There are a lot of people think that one of the reasons oil prices are high is because of the high euro. I just don't buy that. But again, I'm not an expert in that.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Chair Hilty. Chair Hilty, I want to also thank you for, all of your work on this issue and for bringing Mr. Simmons. This is very, very important. I agree it's one of the defining issues of our century, and I did have a question about oil company profits. Before I did that, I wanted to make a quick comment in response to Representative Briner's question about what we do on the local level here, and I think in a couple of weeks we're going to have an opportunity to really respond to this issue with the transportation bill, and we have very strong transit provisions in that bill, and I think a robust urban and rural transit system will go a long way in both addressing global warming and peak oil, at least initially here in Minnesota. So I wanted to remind people of that coming up. But Mr. Simmons, hearing over the weekend again that Exxon outbid itself for the second year in a row with record profits, I think $41 billion, more than ever in history. How does that level of profit relate to forecast projections, this whole kind of peak oil issue? Do you see any relationship, and what accounts for that just astronomical record oil company profit?
It's simple as can be. When Mobil and Exxon merged together, they created a production base that's basically 4.2 million barrels a day. And had oil prices stayed where they thought they wouldn't be making that much money. But because they were wrong on their prediction of oil prices and gas prices, you just take, natural gas and average is probably, see, in Europe, gas trades sells at the same level as oil. So. But in simple terms, if all they had is oil production, you just take 4 million barrels a day times an average of $88 a barrel, which is what we averaged in 2007, and add out by 365 days and estimate their operating cost minus taxes, and they just earned $41 billion. As I have said from time to time, because I've been a pretty outspoken critic of how wrong conventional wisdom and the major oil companies were conventional wisdom have been. So I'm not a big, rabid fan of trying to defend them, but it's not their fault nor their credit. I wouldn't give them a big bonus because they were wrong in their oil price forecast either.
Mr. Chairman, so how much of, thank you, Mr. Chairman, so when we have $3 gas at the pump, how much of that $3 then is this speculative piece or this profit piece? Do you have a...
Well, what are the ironies of their record profits is that in the last 3 to 6 months, the downstream part of the oil industry, and it's still a big part of an ExxonMobil, is just getting killed because oil prices went way up and finished products didn't. And so the only way a refinery makes money is if they can charge a lot more for finished products than they pay for oil. And that's called, refinery spread. So had finished product prices gone up, they probably would have reported $50 billion. But what's also amazing is that the American Petroleum Institute does some pretty good ads here, but they're they're trying to defend the fact that these profits are normal. They don't have anything to do with that. But they do show that the average service station operator, it might be an Exxon branded service station, but these are mom and pop businesses. And they're operating on the tiniest of margins. And it's a risky business because if they top up their underground tanks and they're paying $2.97 and then 3 days later it's $3.91, they should wipe out their profit for a month. So there isn't a lot of, until you get into the upstream, there's not a lot of margin between all your costs. And you know, unless you have, there was a period of time when our complex refineries, which are these massive refineries that can take heavy oil, which always sells at a big discount to light oil, and refine them into light finished products. Well, if you have one of those refineries today, you can buy Lloydminster Blend, which is heavy oil out of Canada, for $65 a barrel, and get your finished product prices that are approximating $92 a barrel, and make a high profit. But it's really, it's not that you're doing anything wrong or illegal, it's just the fact that it's a flow through. Very complicated business, though, because what I also find amazing is if the industry ever got about rebuilding itself, it would need all of these profits plus to get the job done, and the recycling of that of the world's biggest construction project would create an incredible shortage of blue-collar jobs, and so blue-collar wages would go way up, and people would go. Yeah, I think the recycling of how these oil prices, finally get done is far more important than the price per se, because we can't control it.
Thank you.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Simmons, that couldn't have been a better segue. There's been a lot of motivation here to transform our strong leadership on energy policy into leadership in the new energy economy and to translate into these very green-collar jobs that we're talking about. The two laws of marketing that come to mind here are be first, and if you can't be first, be best. And I'm wondering if you can provide any guidance to us in terms of leveraging a leadership position, especially on peak oil, into the economic opportunity and investment that we need vis-a-vis other states, other provinces. And would we be first? Do we need to be in a best first? Or are there little things that other states have done that we should be doing better to continue to solidify this position for investment and job growth?
Well, there's not much of a race right now, so I think that to be best and first wouldn't be very hard. I'm not being facetious, but what's also interesting is that the myriad of industrial products that go into building gas plants and refineries and drilling rigs and it goes on and on. There are a bunch of they're gaskets and flanges and fittings and valves and pipe bending and so forth, and that whole industry basically suffered through a 30-year depression because nothing was being done, and a lot of the parts of the economy that are going to prosper vitally as we start on this are up around in New England, for instance, there are a bunch of companies that are sort of around the Foxborough era that we used to call on all the time in the 70s. We were doing a lot of investment banking in the valve business, and they all went under. Forgot valve out there. But so I think there's going to be a lot of problems. There's a lot of the manufacturing base that used to be in Minnesota and surrounding areas that basically kind of withered away because there weren't any orders. They're going to come back. And so these are basically not green-collar jobs. These are a return to high-quality blue-collar jobs. Welders and so forth. The amount of people shortage in the industry is unbelievable today. That's another thing I really didn't address. The people got too old.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Simmons, on energy stuff, my main policy passion is on the efficiency, conservation, demand side. And we have so much work to do there. We need to not only do the infrastructure piece for the short term, which is a 30 to 50 year, sort of elongation of that of the supply that we have, but really need to transform our economy and right quick. I just want to thank you for being here and pushing this, and encourage you to go out more and more, because just for your information, we are the Silicon Valley of windows. that Anderson, Marvin, Cardinal Glass, 3M Films, Sage Electrochromis, this new dynamic glazing industry that's ripe and ready. The stronger that we can have building standards and a push for efficiency nationally and around the world, the more these windows are going to come from Minnesota. It's a small piece of that picture, but keep pounding that pavement. The more you can talk about the need for tighter building standards in other states, the better Minnesota will be. So keep going.
You know, I'll make a plug for one of my dear friends who's a fellow, who's a Minnesotan, Dick Moe, who's the head of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and I happen to be on his board. Dick has transformed the National Trust to try to give them more relevance. For why do we restore things in a new campaign? Basically say the embedded energy that's in our old buildings is unbelievable compared to the energy we spend tearing something down and then the energy we spend rebuilding. No one's ever thought about that before. And there's no better showcase for historic preservation in the United States than the St. Paul, you know, Twin City area. So I think that's another very important aspect of energy efficiency that's going to come to the forefront.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very quick comment, as I know we're going to consider some related legislation here in the bonding bills, that my training is in architecture, and one of the things that we talk about is, as we define the role or the meaning of the term sustainable, that sometimes having higher embedded energy and a more and greater upfront cost of building very, very well, so that the community values it and wants to preserve those buildings over the long term, you know, 200 and 300 years down the road, that is often the most sustainable building when you look at the total life cycle cost. And so I appreciate you saying that.
Good. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty. And to Mr. Simmons, I just want to let you know that I've studied this issue and I kept trying to come up with questions, but you answered all of them throughout your presentation. I think it was a very thorough presentation, and from all the study and the research that I've looked into, a lot of the scientists and geologists were saying that we're going to peak sometime between 1995 and 2015 or 2020, 2025, but I think our time might be sooner rather than later for peak oil production. I'm still trying to figure out, though, why a successful business person as yourself and an investment banker would have looked into this issue of peak oil production, and why you would essentially be coming forward and upsetting the apple cart with the petroleum industry. So could you please shed some light on what truly was the catalyst behind your work here, and why are you going around the country telling this story?
Well, it's a long, complicated story. I'll try to shorten and say that as I stumbled into the seeing the oil industry through the eyes of the oil service industry, because that's always been our, for years, that's all our firm did, I early on started realizing these are really interesting companies, and they're doing an important task, because, you know, we're not going to have this stuff forever. I didn't understand renewable at all. It just seemed to me that it was a lot harder to expand 1 million barrels a day of supply than most people were giving credit to that task back in the 70s. And in the 80s, as we collapsed the industry through a concept, we had a massive oil glut. And you know, I saw our client base basically. We were at ground zero of a nuclear bomb explosion. The wide oil service industry, which is all of petroleum equipment suppliers, within about a year and a half or 2 years, most of them were down to 10% of the business they had. About 90% of business went under. And we did one restructuring project after another, and I started going back and saying, why were all the energy experts wrong that were predicting? And then I started realizing how obvious supply and demand stuff was if you dug it out. And ever since then, I've become a petroleum data nut. And I just, you know, on a weekend, I basically look at petroleum data. $5 will say he's a little bit crazy sometimes. But in the 90s, we came through the 80s. I thought, well, our firm didn't disappear. Unbelievable. But I thought, we're making every mistake in the book about oil field technology, which we saved. It's not making oil cheaper. Oil can't stay at these cheap prices, or we're going to have a train wreck. And I started speaking out about depletion. I didn't mean we depleted our oil resources. I meant what we don't know about decline curves. And I was about 10 years ahead of almost anyone in the industry speaking about decline curves. But, you know, it was making our firm a famous firm without having to advertise. You know, that wasn't the reason I was doing it, but I found early on that if you've done your homework and you speak out right, even though you're going against the grain of the oil industry, it at least creates people thinking. And then in the early part of in 2000, I spent a lot of time helping edit and prepare the comprehensive energy plan for one of our two presidents of the United States in the campaign. I didn't know the term peak oil. I tried to get every issue I knew about on the plate. I thought we had just terrible energy issues we were headed into. And then about a year later, I got interested in a question: what are the largest producing oil fields in the world in terms of production? Don't get on this reserve because it doesn't mean anything. I couldn't believe that people didn't have a list. So I embarked on it all fall on this treasure hunt of taking all the data you could find country by country and, you know, backing in. She said, okay, Saudi Arabia is producing 8.5 million barrels a day. They only have 6 fields that are produced. The 6 fields collectively can't be more than 8. How do you allocate that? I finally came up with a big white paper that I've occasionally done. And again, no one asked me to do this. Just kind of like to do them. And it basically said that we have, as far as I can determine, 110 oil fields in the world left that produce over 100,000 barrels a day. And they count for 49% of our daily supply, and they're all vastly too old. Top 14 fields in the world at the time, if I was vaguely right about in terms of production, were 20% of our global supply, and they were over 50 years old. And that's the first time I realized that in the Middle East, there were only 35 to 40 oil fields of any size that ever produced anything. Before that, I'd been told so many times, I mean hundreds of times, and heard thousands of times, there's oil every place in the Middle East. And it's so inexpensive, you just have to dig a hole and oil comes out. I never thought it was that simple. And I always thought, you know, the problem is we'll never have enough rigs to do that. But I had no earthly idea that we had such a small number of old fields. And that gave me the historical context of when I got asked on an accidental trip to be part of a delegation by one of the Hunt family members in Dallas to be guest of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for a grand total of 6 days in early February 2003. By the time I came back, I said, something doesn't meet the smell test. These presentations we had, the use of fuzzy logic. The reason we're finding so much technology, it now takes fuzzy logic to know how to maximize our reserves. I thought, wait a second. If they have 25% of the world's reserves and it's a 200-year life, what's fuzzy about that? And that led me into this data search and the technical papers. And once I got into it, first of all, I started telling enough people I'm going to produce this into a book, that I thought, if I don't, I've got to have a darn good reason for it. And once that was done, my thinking about our energy problems, of we're going to have some serious problems to address, but I meant serious that we just need to do a little bit more, you know, went across the spectrum to this is the biggest problem we've ever faced. And then I realistically said, I'm retired as, you know, really day-to-day investment banking. I had to do that to finish the book. And how do I want to spend the rest of my career? Well, I have some close friends that have decided to enter the public service area through, you know, like the mayor of Houston. I wouldn't want that job for an hour. But, you know, Bill White has spent 6 years of his life doing that. And I thought, Sam Bodman, the Department of Energy, I wouldn't want that job for an hour. And I thought, the one thing I do know is I think I understand this area. I didn't plan on understanding it, but I do. And I also think that I know how to communicate stuff, because we had to do that to our oil field clients, particularly in the 80s, to convince them, wake up, you're going to go out of business if you don't restructure. I thought, this is the one part of public service that I can do on my own time, and it's sure a lot better than running for some office, which if I won, I'd hate it. Long answer to a simple question.
Representative Weston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Simmons, Representative Welty, one of the questions out of my mouth, I've been questioning, what is your motivation? And so I appreciate that answer. You touched on it briefly, but alternative fuels, your thoughts of ethanol, biodiesel, syngas, technologies that we're trying to embark on is one question. How does that play in curbing some of the demand and the addiction to a traditional oil? Second question I'll ask you at the same time. you made the comment about electric or fuel is our only way of transportation. We have at least heard about, and there's talk about new electric car technologies, and we've had some inventors or researchers in our area at least come forward with some ideas of potential opportunities. Do you really think we're that far away from an electric car concept that at least significantly reduces the need for fuel? So, two questions, if you could answer those.
Yeah, on the biofuel arena as we know it today, there's a lot of promise in some of the the non feedstock biofuels like wood chips and switchgrass, and you know the list goes on and on. But when I talk to people that are experts in that area, they say virtually every one of them takes a different enzyme process to break down, so you finally end up with the process that creates it. And we haven't broken the DNA yet on any single one of them. And I just think you shouldn't be relying on a solution when you haven't invented the solution yet. You should be a pessimist and say, let's assume we can't invent it until someone says, aha, I now know this works. And then what's really discouraging is you look at these bold announcements of a new form of biofuel, biodiesel, recirculating, recycling plastic and turning it into high quality, and you switch it from gallons per year, which they almost all get taught in terms of this looks at 280,000 gallons per year, and you go back to barrels per day. You say we're trying to address a market in the United States between motor gasoline and diesel. We're using 13 million barrels a day. And so if you end up with 20,000 barrels a day of a biofuel, it's terrific. But it doesn't move the needle in any sort of material way. That also gets me discouraged about, I fully believe that we will have some fabulous new types of cars that will come out of all of this. In fact, there's a car that was featured in USA Today about 3 weeks ago. Starts with an A, and it's being made as we speak north of San Diego, and it looks like kind of a spaceship on wheels. It's a three-car vehicle, and apparently it gets 180 miles per gallon. But the production line, if they get 1,000 of them out this year, will be amazing. And we have 900 million vehicles on the road, so it's the turnover of the existing fleet that takes so long that we won't. I mean, that's probably one area that the free market will basically stop. I think for a state to give some, economic incentive to develop that stuff here is terrific. But I think that to think, oh, we could solve our problem by designing a new fleet. We just, if the problem were 80 years away, then I'd buy into that. But if the problem is near and imminent and potentially damaging is what I believe, then I just think, we ran out the clock. We should have done that 2 decades ago.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up. Appreciate
that. You're welcome.
That answer. Getting to the theory that you hold, and I've heard what you said. Several people say, well, there's many oil fields out there. We just have new technologies to go drill deeper, et cetera, et cetera. And I've heard the Colorado. The lands in Colorado and Wyoming, if we can drill deep enough, prove to hold quite a bit of oil. ANWR, I don't know what remember the quantities of that, but do you really think it's not 80 years away in that we can find more oil? And as we dig deeper, we'll keep finding it? I mean, do you think it is no chance that it's 80 years out?
Well, in the oil exploration business, the oil and gas exploration business, some of the greatest fields we've ever found were found, as an operation was winding down after a decade of dismal success or failure. Prudhoe Bay, the North Sea, there's always a chance that we basically find, open up a new frontier. But we're faced today, which I didn't really mention other than the age of our rigs, we have a chronic shortage in oil field equipment, including drilling rigs. And our offshore rig fleet, which is newer than our land rig fleet in the world, we have about 500 offshore rigs, and last year, they, on average, were 25 years old. That's the age at which, historically, offshore rigs always went to the junkyard. to pick them up with putting good money after bad. So I don't think in the next decade we have any prospect of creating enough spare rigs that will be able to basically drill the basement of Wyoming. More because those wells, I mean, the deeper you go, you're not talking about wells that get drilled in 30 days. You're talking about wells that get drilled in 9 months to a year per well. And then I look at the last three great frontiers that the world ever found. Ironically, came 1, 2, 3. In 1977, the Soviets basically discovered their oil in Western Siberia. They had had a decade of really miserable drilling results in Western Siberia, and they were getting paranoid about the fact that oil was their only resource, and they couldn't fight an arms race. And all of a sudden, here comes Western Siberia. Within a year, ARCO on the North Slope found Prudhoe Bay, and that opened up the North Slope. Within a year later, Phillips Petroleum was winding up with several years of dismal exploration in the southern part of the North Sea, and they found Ekofisk. All three were kind of, they were ready to quit. But you look at Western Siberian oil, and it peaked at about probably 6 million barrels a day, and it's down now to maybe even 6 million barrels a day today, but the fields are all way, way lower than they were individually. You look at the North Slope, and it peaked in 1989. You look at the North Sea, and it took 30 years to go from zero to 6.1 million barrels a day in 1999, and it's half of that today. So if we found a new North Sea, realistically, could you hope for that being producing 6 million barrels a day within a decade? I'd say no, maybe two decades. We could lose that in 18 months of some of these giant oil fields declining. So I just don't see how the numbers work. And then you have to go back and say, we've done the most intensive exploration. We have better exploration tools today. The major oil companies aren't sitting on their hands. They're basically spending, they're spending all the money they can spend. They just say that it's just not enough to get ahead of the S-curve. We've used up all the rigs in the world. And you look at the last 15 years, and the amount of discoveries that's gone like that, headed way south, and the amount of size per discovery has gone way south. And I think, realistically, we might have actually drilled up all of the great last fields we'll ever find. I keep thinking, around the corner will probably come another great field, but if it does, it's going to be 2015 before it's on stream, where these projects, like in the Caspian Sea, there's a project called Kashagan, and it's been highly touted as the world's greatest oil field found in the 21st century, and it was supposed to be on stream by 2005, and then it just went from one problem to another, and finally they apparently have resolved it. Kazakhstan wants twice as much share of the field before they'd let the project proceed, but they're now talking about spending $137 billion for it's a very low quality oil, it's a very complicated series of reservoirs, it's in a complicated part of the world geographically because the Caspian Sea freezes up in the winter. I wouldn't spend $100,000 investing in that. But they're talking about, if it all works, it could basically exceed 1 million barrels a day by 2019 to 2025. They said for $137 billion. And so I just add all of these real life experiences up and say, it's real hard for me to get real optimistic about we're about to discover something where we don't even have the rigs to look for them.
Representative Afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've convinced, I think, a lot of us of the severity of this problem, and I'm just trying to think, you're talking about them spending almost 10 years of our state budget to look for this oil field, just as a sense of what we're investing in the state of Minnesota. But stepping back about what we do about it, I've lived in cities where they're pre-oil cities, they're built so you can get around and function and not have to use oil too extensively if you think about what you're eating. But I think the United States has a bunch of during cheap oil cities and states, and I'm wondering if and we basically operate on the idea that price sets what you're going to do and you're functioning if oil is the water of our economy in the United States and the world. Do you have any examples of cities that have, without that price signal, the price signal of oil going up extensively, who've basically built a city where you don't need a whole bunch of oil, or have changed their city in ways that reduce that?
Well, I'll tell you one example that did it for a totally different reason. Is my hometown of Salt Lake City. To prepare for the Winter Olympics of 2002, they put in light rail, because it was really the only way that they could cope with the transportation. The Olympics were spread all over Greater Salt Lake Valley, and it was very controversial, because there were a lot of people that thought, oh, we'll just save, we'll lose so much money on this. But it turned out that the use of the light rail has just been astonishing. And so now they're talking about extending light rail all the way down to south of Provo, Utah, to north of Ogden, Utah, along the Wasatch Front. Well, in Utah, that really makes a difference, because you have the Wasatch Mountains and the Great Salt Lake, and so about 80% of Utah are down this narrow corridor, so that light rail makes a sense. In Houston, Texas, we grew like a mushroom, and so we have 5 miles of light rail that also worked far better than the city planners ever thought, but we can't figure out where to put another line in, because no one wants it in their backyard, because it does just, you know, tear up a neighborhood. So it's but you know, you get some cities like Charleston, South Carolina, Portland, Maine, they really rejuvenated themselves into downtown areas that are just thriving. Mid-coast Maine, and so forth. And people really are basically, you know, within bicycles before they go to work, and so forth. And lots of, there's also I should have thought of this when it was asked about the new cars. I keep getting emails from a guy named Bill James, who's a West Point graduate, and a lot of mutual friends say he's terrific. He has a transportation system called J-Pod. And I've just seen pictures of this, but basically you kind of, they're like a tram. But you individually get in this kind of, and apparently their first installation is being installed in Malls of America. So right here in your backyard. So when I say electricity too, light rail is a great use of electricity for transportation. But transportation, you know, electricity in a car, I think it's just a long, long ways from being big enough to be relevant. Don't know if that really precisely addressed your question or not, but.
Maybe this is an opportunity for me to ask a more general question, but it would relate specifically to this in comparison to the balance between policy and markets. So that you had said something about markets are grossly inefficient, and then you said price cures all ills, which I hesitate to say that I heard it first as Christ cures all ills. But all this talk, market's grossly inefficient, and then we have problems. So how do you balance out where policy needs to step in and where you step back and let be?
It's a ticklish balance, but it seems to me that there are a handful of things in our society, and right at the top of the list has to be energy, because without it, we don't have a society, that are so unbelievably important that to leave it to the whims of the free market and just think of it all, you know, is a big mistake. That doesn't need to mean that we ought to nationalize the whole energy business every place and run it. But I think there's a fine balance between no guidance and some strict regulations and some tax policy that gives people the right incentives to do the right thing and so forth, and versus just letting the free market, you know, sort things out. My comment about high prices cure all ills is that high prices are going to be good news for addressing these issues of peak oil and rebuilding the oil system. It was low prices that were such a consumer's folly that really led people to thinking there is no price of energy. So that's what I mean by the benefit of high prices, is that if you spend the prices right, you know, there's an issue that rarely gets discussed, but if, you know, the Middle East oil producers, countries, they're going to have a window as their oil production heads south of some unbelievable, unprecedented amount of wellhead revenue. And if they follow the lead of Dubai, which has become the Hong Kong Singapore of the Middle East, and, you know, over the top in funny sense, I think there's a prospect 10 years from now we could have permanent peace in the Middle East, because you create enough prosperity and jobs you know, climb back the oil revenues. And, you know, if you look at the history of the world, when people get prosperous, look at Ireland. When they finally got prosperous, they buried the hatchet of a 100-year problem that looked intractable. So that's another benefit of high prices. But that's quite different than saying high prices fix the problem like the economists think it does.
Speaking of high prices, I suppose you knew this was coming sooner or later, but you want to address at least briefly the question of natural gas.
Yeah, our natural gas problems in the United States are extremely serious. And again, this is another of my kind of how did I get so involved in this. I started seeing firsthand in the late 90s the impact which oil field technology was having on decline rates in natural gas. And I also got roped into being one of the task force chairmen for this huge report that the National Petroleum Council did on the long-term outlook for natural gas as America turns its whole energy future into the hands of natural gas on the concept we had abundant amounts of it. And as I started into this, and I watched all these ideas, these guys are hallucinating. We do have domestic natural gas, but to think that we can grow the supply by 50% is preposterous. We're not measuring the decline curve. And that was as controversial back in 2000, 2001 as peak oil is today. And the same optimists on peak oil, you know, like Sarah, just to be very specific, we're publicly in record of scoffing at these naysayers on natural gas, saying we don't have any problems in natural gas. And about 2 years later, they said, oh my gosh, the decline curves we have in natural gas now are unbelievable. Well, where were they 6 years before that? Then I started realizing Canada had just as serious a problems as we do. And then finally I started realizing when I got through doing the research on Saudi Arabia's oil and I saw how limited amount of natural gas that they actually have versus what they thought they had, I started doing some more work on kind of the global natural gas picture, and I thought, this is unbelievable. Most of our stranded gas has never seen a drill bit. That's undiscovered gas. These great volumetric estimates of the structure that if we ever put you know, drill bits in a well, it would flow oil forever. The North Field in Gutter was the largest oil field, gas field in the world. It was fine on one producing platform, Alpha. It was okay on the second one, but when they were drilling Charlie about 4 years ago, they drilled dry holes just on the rim of the field. So they know nothing about the real size of that. And so that got me into concluding that the data on natural gas makes oil data look pristine. But because natural gas is a vapor, it can flow. You can actually, it is your balloon that you pop. If you want, we have the technology to suck a natural gas reservoir dry, as long as it's not in tight rocks, you know, in less than a year. And that we basically have to start weaning ourselves from how we're using natural gas. It should be probably illegal at some point to use natural gas to feedstock for power generation. Then use electricity to create heat. If you use electricity in the industrial markets to melt metals and burn liquids, what you're doing is you're taking natural gas BTUs in at about 9,000, you're getting them out at 3,400, which is a kilowatt hour, and then you're using electricity as a replacement for natural gas, which probably maybe gives you two-thirds of efficiency. Put it under a burner tip. Use natural gas for heating solely. But we don't have enough natural gas to do that, and we don't probably have enough coal right now to actually back up natural gas. So when you get out, this has all been about oil today, because I've found when you try to talk about the whole complex, it gets so utterly complicated that you just leave. But I think that natural gas is a serious problem. The idea we were going to have cheap gas forever was just lunacy. That's what the industry believes. You ask about the major oil companies. The industry believed in the NPC report, five volumes that get sent to Capitol Hill. It still is the most credible report we've ever had. They believed and codified that natural gas could grow from 21 to 30 TCF by 2010. And by all the way through 2015, it would stay below $3 per MCF, other than occasional spikes. And it took 9 months before natural gas basically was at $7 at Henry Hub, and we finally realized that we had a problem. Then 2 years later, Spencer Abraham asked the NPC to go back and totally redo the report, because every aspect of it was wrong. They went back to the drawing board and put another report out saying, well, natural gas is going to remain flat for a while because of the decline curve. Then we're going to have this unbelievable onrush of LNG, and we'll be back to the horse races. No, we're not. LNG is not going to work. So I think that we need to get used to the fact that gas is scarce. If you ever had to choose, this is sort of a Hobson's choice of the highest order, between, you're going to have to either choose between the use of oil or the use of natural gas. Since oil is transportation fuel, always pick natural gas, because natural gas is the world's only efficient source of heat. You can turn it on, you can turn it off, and without heat, people actually die in cold weather. Without oil, you just stay home.
I waited until the end of the hearing to bring that up. I realize that it always complicates things immensely, but I think we're at the point that we only have the true believers left, so we're probably okay. Are there further questions from members?
I want to commend you all on the thoughtfulness of your questions and your awareness of these issues.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Norm. I'm with a couple of different groups, one of which is Minnesota Futurist, and so looking into the future is one of our great pastimes. The other group is the Minnesotans United for Immigration Reduction. Now, if you think that's irrelevant, that really addresses this question of how to use less oil. We now have about 303 million people in this country, and I don't think there's any one of them that doesn't use his or her share of oil. 30 years ago, we had 200 million people here. Without immigration, we would have about 220 million people. And of that 83 million people extra that we now have here, I see some of the true believers are leaving.
Well, but you're going to have to consider that.
Did you have a question?
The question
I would entertain
is,
really a forum for it.
Well, if you
want to testify on the issue in general, it'll be possible to do that when we're in regular session and we have a regular committee.
I understand
hearing.
That, but I just wanted to make the point that how to use less oil is going to mean inevitably changes in our immigration system, so that we don't keep adding 100 million people every 30 years. We did that in the last 30 years. It's all based upon an illusion, as Mr. Simmons has pointed out. It's an illusion that we have. It's unfortunate. We have, it's for a variety of reasons. It's buried into our culture. We think we have an unlimited supply of everything, and we just keep one thing after another. We just keep using it up and burning it up until there's no more left. And then we wonder, what the heck happened? This is the entire subject here of oil. That is, or fossil fuels, that is a moral issue. First and foremost, it's a moral issue. We cannot continue to make that assumption that there's no end to everything. So,
you're not going to get any argument from me about that, Mr. Erickson, but I do think that this is not the appropriate time to entertain extended commentaries. We didn't give anybody else the opportunity to do that, and you will have the opportunity to do that once we're in regular session. So if you don't actually have a question, I think this is the point at which we'll just stop.
Well, thank you for allowing me to make this comment.
Mr. Simmons, I want to offer my really profound thanks, and you know my sincerity about that, for taking the time out of your enormously busy schedule to come to Minnesota on one of our less congenial weather days and to spend as much time as you have with us. This has been an extraordinarily enlightening session, I think, and we are very grateful for your taking the time to do that.
I understand you're willing to make yourself available further for media if any of them are still left, and I think that if there are no further questions at this point from members, and I don't see any, that we will adjourn. I should point out to members that in your packets there was a copy of the Peak Oil Resolution, which was testimony, I think, clearly enough addressed. And if you, I didn't even mention the resolution to begin with, because I think in light of the testimony, if you take the time to read the resolution, you might find that it's more appropriate than you might have thought 3 hours ago. And in addition, I think I sent electronically to all the members of the committee, but also there's a hard copy in your packets of a report that a group of legislators in Connecticut made to the legislature and the governor in Connecticut, which I think you will find also in light of Mr. Simmons' testimony today, and enlightening and appropriate response. So with that, again, Mr. Simmons, thank you very much for your testimony, and this meeting is adjourned.